This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed.
Mm-hmm. Sharon Lawson Bram, skidamarinky-dinky-dink.
Yeah.
Skidamarinky-doo.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I've wanted to drive that freaking hoe train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pie. Watch your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening, back inside the PTB studios. And Scott Criscola, sir, it's been a lengthy week since we last spoke. A lot has happened in our lives and worlds, and how are you doing?
I am very well. Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 441 of the Gold Standard, the mothership. By the way, they show Dusty today because... on the WWE Network stream was WrestleMania 30 today, and he was in the crowd. It was probably one of his last big... he died in 2000... Yeah, he died in 2014, so... probably one of his last
God,
big things.
God, was
thing,
it already 14?
Yeah.
Is it him? No, it was 15, right?
It was 15, yeah.
Okay, okay, so one more year, okay. Whose voice is that, everyone? We'll let you know in a moment. He breaks the third wall. But anyway, it's been a very long week, and tomorrow's going to be a very long fucking day because I'm just angry at weather. I'm just angry at it, and I want it to go away. There's a rule. No snow after March 1st. Just the way it is. We haven't had it in, 9 years.
Didn't it snow in
March
last
I was happy
year?
With that. No, not that I know of. No, not like this. Maybe a flurry, but not like this. But it pisses me off. I get tired of TV stations. The official Place to Be Nation... we use Weather Underground. It's the official weather site of Place to Be Nation. And it was 8 to 12 around here for 2 weeks. But you go to – I mean, some of these TV stations are outrageous. I know you like your boy on Fox 2 there, or Fox 5, whatever his name is, in Providence. But, I mean, there's 26 to 35 and 97 mile per hour winds. I mean, it's like the, what is that, the Day After Tomorrow movie? I mean, it's ridiculous up here. Yeah. Just because it's in March, suddenly we're all going to die. I mean, it's snow. It blows, but you move on from it.
Yeah, it seems like I've seen New York reports that seem kind of crazy. Here has been pretty steady with 8 to 12. They're saying it could be 12 to 18 in some areas, but I mean, everyone's been pretty hard on the 8 to 12 for at least 5 or 6 days now. So I think that's probably where we're going to top out. And they're saying it's going to start earlier now here, which is good. It'll be done earlier on Tuesday. So,
yeah, I think it's starting about 4 here, about 4 a.m. here, and then finish 8 tomorrow night, something like that.
That's good.
It's supposed to be heavy.
I'm going to the Celtics game Wednesday night, so I just wanted to be, as long as the roads are clear, that I can get there.
Will you be paying attention to the Celtics game, though? That's the question.
Well, yeah, because luckily the Friars are not playing till 9:10. At least that's when they're scheduled. But they probably won't tip off until 9:30 with those games. So we're going to – I mean, the Celtics game starts at 7:30. So we're going to watch as much as we can and then go to a bar and watch the Friars. So.
Oh, good, good. But tonight, JR, we've already talked about the 1985 NCAA tournament, mm-hmm. but the 85-86 college basketball season will start in a little bit. But we will talk more about sports later on. Let us bring in, as you already heard his voice, our guest for this evening, JR. And he's not really a guest. He's more like our he's kind of our Undertaker or Brock Lesnar in terms of appearance deals. Tell us who we have tonight, JR, back in our studio.
Yeah, it's our Freebird, you know, our third Freebird. He's the third
right.
man in the booth
here. Billy Jack Roberts.
I'm Buddy Jack, baby.
That's right. We'll give you the Freebird cream.
Yeah, hopefully you last a little bit longer than Buddy Jack did, though. And then that the voice of that, of course, the man, one of the co-hosts of the former Titans of Wrestling and many other shows that we've covered in his previous appearance here, and that is the one and only Kelly Nelson. Kelly, I think we could put to bed like the other shows you've kind of hosted, and we're gonna call you now our PTBN third man. I mean, that's it. That's what, PTB podcast third man, I should say. That's what you are for me going forward now.
Yep.
Cool. Yeah, that's totally fair. My wrestling podcasts other than this are pretty much retired. Yeah, that's fair.
It's good to have you on, and another great show tonight. I guess depending on your point of view, there was a huge highlight and I wouldn't say low lights, but a lot of uninspired lights tonight. Let's go into our offices, gentlemen. It is October 21st, 1985, live from our home office, Madison Square Garden in New York City.
I was just there.
A couple weeks after our, yes, you were, sorry, tough loss. For the Friars, but congrats to Mr. Woodling's Wildcats. Mm-hmm. They're a number one seed. In fact, my personal bracket, I like them winning the whole thing. It should be interesting. But we'll talk more about that Wednesday night. So we are in the Garden this evening, and this is the only show in town. There is no second card on this evening. They were at the Hartford Civic Center, and I think in Oakland the night before, and then that Tuesday morning, that Tuesday was their big Poughkeepsie taping. So just the one show this evening at the Garden. JR, give us our roll call. What do we got?
Here we go. Hulk Hogan, 637 days into his reign. Tito Santana, 107 days into his. The Dream Team, 58 days as tag team champions. And Wendy Richter, still hanging on, 204 days into her reign as women's champion. And a few other fun facts here, courtesy of Mr. Jarvis. King Tonga, this is what's gone down since our last show, Scott, and that was the 10-3 Saturday Night's Main Event. King Tonga, who we'll talk about in a bit here tonight, had made his debut on 10-5 edition of Championship Wrestling. Bret Hart, Jim Neidhart, referred to as the Hart Foundation for the first time on TV on 10-5. Grab Them Cakes debuted as JYD's theme song on 10-12 Championship Wrestling, so big times there. WrestleMania 1, now available on VHS and Beta for $39.95. Times have changed there.
Wow.
And Real American played for the first time on TV, but it is the music for, of course, Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo.
Mike Rotundo. That's right.
That debuted on 10-12. And an interesting show, and Kelly, I want your take on this one before we get into tonight's proceedings. On 10-19, the WWF held an outdoor show in San Juan, Puerto Rico for a crowd of 1,200 yes. people. Halfway through the event during Hulk Hogan versus Big John Studd, a heavy rain began to fall, and the show went on in miserable conditions. Of course, the video is out there as well if you've never seen it. I'm sure most people probably have at this point. Gorilla
it's on,
Monsoon.
I think it's on the Hulk Still Rules DVD.
That matches,
actually.
Yeah. I feel like the whole show aired. I think it was on 24/7, because I feel like I have it somewhere. But
yes.
Gorilla Monsoon with the poncho at ringside and everything else, just awful. And they reference it here.
They do,
which
yes, they do.
We'll talk about. But Kelly, any thoughts on that show, like having seen it in the past?
Yeah, Johnny and I did a Mystery Titans Theater on it last year, and that was the first time I'd watched it in full. Like you said, a few matches appeared here and there. It's a bit lost him, but it's really. I think it's during the Hogan Stud match that it really starts to get bad, and they're slipping around the ring. And then, like, the rest of the matches are cut short because nobody wants to get hurt. So they're really just a bunch of short matches. Cyndi Lauper was there, actually. I think probably one of her last appearances on a WWF show. She was with Richter, of course. Kind of funny, she went all the way to Puerto Rico for it. It's a great spectacle to see. It's on YouTube. Richard Land uploaded it, so check it out.
Here's the card. have it right in front of me. It's from Hiram Bithorn Stadium. That's the baseball stadium where like the Expos went in the 2000s. Right. And so here it is. Tony Atlas pinned Steve Lombardi. Corporal Kirshner beat Tiger Lee Chung Lee. Ricky Steamboat pinned Moondog Spot. Your women's champion, Wendy Richter, defeated the Spider Lady. I wonder who that is. With the Fabulous Moolah. Hulk Hogan beat Big John Studd. Of course, that's when it started to pour. And the apron, if you remember, the apron was like 4 inches off the ground. It's like the lowest ring ever. B. Brian Blair, the B. Brian Blair, and Jim Brunzel, the Killer Bees, beat Iron Mike Sharp and Barry O. Interesting tag team. Not the last time we'll mention them this evening. And Tito Santana beat Randy Savage. And Pedro Morales was in the main event. What a shock. Pinned the Spoiler in a minute 14. Wow, they really did cut this short. A minute 14 main event. What was the ring was floating in the ocean at that point? Wow. So that was 2 days before this show. So that was on a Saturday night. So that was a Saturday night show. So they all got back. Barely.
Barely.
So, barely.
It was okay. A monsoon featuring Gorilla Monsoon.
Monsoon. any more notes, JR? Anything else?
More from Mr. Jarvis as we move through the matches, as we matriculate through the card. But for now, we are good.
All right, good. All right, we will jump into the card right now. Gorilla and Jesse back in the seat. Jesse's second straight show. He was actually third straight show for us. He was at the September 23rd house show. And, of course, he was on Saturday Night's main event with Vincent. And Vince comes out later. And I have an interesting question about Vince's appearance on this house show in a little bit because it begs the question about something. Because
it begs the question about a lot of things.
Well, that's true too. Our opener is the minute I saw these first two names when the clip started today, I went, oh,
ugh.
No. Oh no. Wow. JR, what do we got?
Well, Scott, we have our old friend Terry Gibbs, who we've seen multiple times here on the show. And he is battling the one, the only, the iconic Steve Gatorwolf. I do have the Gatorwolf background, which I'm going to read. And then I want Kelly, our jobber lover, to maybe give us a few extra details about Mr. Gatorwolf. So Stephen Nathaniel Ketcher, better known in the wrestling world as Steve Gatorwolf, grew up in Florida where he dropped out of high school before becoming a professional wrestler in 1976, wrestled in the AWA as enhancement talent before joining WWF in 1984. During his tenure from 84 to 90, he used as a prelim wrestler. According to Bret Hart, they actually had plans for Gatorwolf to be a big Indian star with action figures and a large marketing plan. This never came to be when his push quickly ended as Gatorwolf had poor performance and forgot how to perform a war dance following his first match. His match tonight would be the only win he'd ever get in the WWF. Quickly pushed down to jobber status. After he left the WWF, he promoted wrestling events on American Indian tribal lands in the southwestern U.S., moved into unsanctioned tough man and MMA events before being arrested in 2008 in Utah for illegal fight promoting. Things turned darker for him in May 2014 when he turned himself into Clay County, Florida officials, wanted on a warrant from Mesa County, Colorado for 7 accounts of sexual assault on a child and sexual assault of a 15-year-old. At the time of his arrest, he was working as a long-haul truck driver, convicted in 2015, sentenced to 16 years to life in prison. So
there's some joke about the term long haul in there, but I think we'll hold off. Wow.
Piece of shit.
Unsolved mysteries all over that right there, huh?
Steve Gatorwolf. But Kelly, anything we missed in there? Any fun facts you'd like to share about Gatorwolf?
Not really. That's kind of what I researched too. He didn't really do a ton in his career outside of the WWF. And he was someone I don't remember at all from this time. And he was on TV quite a bit, 85, 86, 87. Basically, you know, an attempt at recreating the magic of Chief J. Strongbow. And, yeah.
The inaugural member of the Titans of Wrestling Hall of Fame right there, Chief J. Strongbow. There it is.
Yeah, you would have been, you know, it would have been better to just keep going with Chief J. Strongbow at this point. Because, Gatorwolf didn't have a lot to offer. And it looks like, after wrestling, his life took a pretty dark turn, that's for sure. Unfortunate. Oh, God.
So bad.
And he is, of course, as we mentioned, taking on Terry Gibbs, who is substituting for the masked superstar here tonight. So first of a couple substitutions for our evening. So here we go. Again, Jesse Ventura back for another month, by the way. Him and Gorilla put over the Greatness of the Garden to open up the show. And again, I enjoyed Alfred for that last couple we had, but Jesse and Gorilla has been great to listen to here. Tough opener on paper is the Native American job boy, Steve Gatorwolf, in the house against the always surly Terry Gibbs. Jesse says Gator Wolf may have been directing traffic downtown before the show, as Gorilla notes that President Reagan was in town to straighten out the UN. Sure, Scott, that
was funny.
Like that. Yeah, 6 to midnight there. Gibbs attacks the bell. At the bell, works Gator Wolf over in the corner, as Jesse puts over Gibbs' style. Gator Wolf comes back with a flurry, mixing in a pin cover before going to the arm into a headlock. Gorilla references Chief J Strongbow as Gator Wolf lands an atomic drop and follows with a chop back into a side headlock. Gorilla tries says Steve is trying to pin Gibbs with a side headlock as a waste of time, but Jesse actually adds some logic to it about how he's using up some energy. Gator Wolf alternates between strikes and rest holds until Gibbs goes to the eyes to turn the tide. Gibbs snaps Gator Wolf down with a neck breaker and applauds himself before getting two. Gibbs goes to a front face lock as Jesse asks Gorilla about his recent vacation in San Juan, and Gorilla says it poured more than he's ever seen in his life. So there's the reference, of course, to that Puerto Rico show. Gibbs gets a two count on an elbow drop. Gator Wolf reverses a whip and lays in a few shots. Gibbs kicks Gator Wolf and then shoves him outside. Gator Wolf heads back in and tries for a sunset flip, but Gibbs just punches him in the face, and the two begin trading blows until Gator Wolf beals Gibbs and got a small package for two. Gibbs blocks a backdrop with a boot to the face and heads up top, but got caught and slammed hard to the mat. Gator Wolf whipped Gibbs into the ropes and caught him in a leaping double tomahawk chop for the win. I thought this was a really sloppy mess. Very few bright spots, and they were all from Gibbs, nothing from Gator Wolf. He has a shit look. He doesn't bump or sell, and he brings nothing to the table besides just being a Native American gimmick. Gibbs, I thought, looked solid in his heel mannerisms, but he never gets much of a chance to shine of anything. I went dud on this, and I don't feel bad about it at all. What did you think, Scott?
Yeah, this match sucks. I mean, this was the opener. This is the match that's gonna even if it was the Masked Superstar against Steve Gator Wolf, that was supposed to jack this crowd up too. I mean, really? Where the fuck was everybody? I mean, come on. Are you serious? I mean, they obviously the rest of them had the day off. I mean, come on. Ludicrous. This was the best you could do to open the show. And yes, he does mention the point when Gorilla says he's pouring water out of his loafers. that was pretty funny. But yeah, there's nothing much to say. It's a dud. I mean, I mean, seriously, I don't understand where the logic comes, Kelly, about putting these two guys to open the show and try to jack a crowd up. I mean, really?
Well,
it's the Garden. We're not in Allentown or whatever. I mean, we're at the Garden. Right. This is the best opener you could do.
True, but I mean, traditionally at this time, the opener was kind of a dud match. They just had people still streaming in, buying popcorn and what have you, just mulling about. They usually put on a pretty lame match, so this kind of fits the bill in that regard. I like Terry Gibbs, though. I think he's one of the better enhancement talents they had at this time.
I feel like he hasn't got enough of a chance, like, at least these shows we've watched, he never gets much shine. And I agree with you because I enjoy him. He really connects with the crowd. He's good at kind of barking and doing that stuff. And like he gets like 2 minutes of it every match and then just gets a shit kicked out of him, which is like rare because every other fucking jobber match goes 30 minutes. You know what I mean? And he gets like no time at
all. Yeah. He was usually put with guys that were really not very good.
Right.
Like, here's Gator Wolf. Another example would be the Ultimate Warrior. When he first started in WWF, he was paired up with Gibbs around the horn, and maybe most famously, Gibbs was married to Tom McGee for about a year or so. The famous failed attempt at a new star in 1986-87.
That's right, the one person Tom McGee fan club. Yeah, we all know about him. I mean, no, I understand, Kelly. I'm not saying we need Brett and Owen or anything, but I mean, usually there's at least one decent worker to work with a jobber kind of heel or jobber kind of face. I mean, this is just, I don't know. I figured at this point, I don't know why they were even attempting, because this is our first look at Steve Gator Wolf for the whole year at the Garden. So I don't know if this was his debut and that they were beginning his push attempt. I think he shows up a little bit in 86, I think. But, it's just putrid. That's just my opinion. It's utterly putrid. And it's a dud, and I do feel bad for Terry Gibbs. Sometimes you got to feel bad for like the real low level jobbers, because their goal is to just try to put the other guy over. But if the other guy is just the drizzling shits, then I mean, what are you gonna do? There's only so much you can do. Guys like Paul Christie, he was one of my favorite jobbers back in the day. We've seen him once or twice, I think, here at the Garden this year. He was one of my favorite jobbers as a kid. He was a good solid worker, put over the talent, knew how to bump, knew how to take the finishers, gave the mannerisms. He was a good heel. But when you're working with a pile of, nothing, What are you going to do? Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this match is just putrid.
Well, that's why they should give Gibbs more of the offense. So, like, he doesn't really get a lot of offense to work over. And I know Gatorwolf's maybe not the best seller, but at least let Gibbs control most of the match. Instead, you got Gatorwolf just working through this terrible offense through majority of this.
It is. Yeah. It's absolutely horrendous.
No, it was terrible. I gave it a half star just out of pity for Gibbs, basically.
And we see some really ridiculous match lengths here. This one goes 7:17, which is probably about 7:12 too long.
It wouldn't have been as bad if Gibbs got most of the offense. Like, to me, that if you're going almost 8 minutes, it had to be the majority. Had to be Gatorwolf. I feel like. I mean, I don't think Gibbs got almost anything in.
Yeah, no, he didn't. He really didn't. It's just so bad. Let's move on. We talked too much about it to begin with already. next up, we have a match that on paper I was actually kind of looking forward to. Two solid guys. Another good enhancement guy, but a veteran enhancement guy, and then one of our favorite personalities, JR, over 1985. What do we got?
Up next here, we do have Adrian Adonis taking on Special Delivery Jones. Of course, Jones is in the house, has his more island-looking gear this month instead of his usual Phillies color, so he's mixing it up. Adrian Adonis out next, who's now managed by Jimmy Hart, Scott, no longer with Bobby Heenan, so that short-lived association's over. Adonis also does not have Trudy with him this week. Jesse mocks Jones's tiny pre-match shorts, and Gorilla says those are walking shorts in Antigua. So it was an odd description, but Adonis gets into it with a fan as Jesse mocks Antigua. Jones meets Adonis on the floor and punches him and shoots him into the ring, and then things get started in there. Jones goes to work on Adonis, who has his jacket on still, and Adonis eventually bails outside to regroup, really stalling and taking his time. After a distraction from Hart, Adonis snuck in and drilled Jones from behind, kicking away in the corner before slingshotting SD into the bottom rope. Adonis slings Jones to the floor and then follows out and clubs away before slamming SD on the concrete. Adonis finally takes his coat off and hammers away at SD, preventing him from getting in the ring. Hart taunts SD as he crawls back to the apron. Gorilla talks about Adonis bulking up as Jesse says he can carry weight well, and while he doesn't look like he's in shape, he is due to his stamina and agility. I think Gorilla talking about Adonis' weight is like the new tick. You know, like we used to, what was the one early on, Scott? He always mentioned the, Moondog Spot Bone. And there's a couple of other ones he says every
Moondog
show.
Moondog Spot Bone, Tony Atlas looks ripped. Right. Somebody's got 20 pounds.
Right. Adonis' weight is like that's been the thing now every show. He's bulked up since the last show. I mean, which isn't wrong, but he calls it out specifically every time. Adonis suplexes SD into the ring and drops an elbow for two. Adonis elbows away at his head. And SD just no-sells it, of course, as Jesse, as her weekly racist comment, says he has a thick skull. SD levels Adonis with a headbutt and then stomps his abdomen before rocking him with a punch that leaves Adrian tangled in the ropes. Adonis works free and out of nowhere catches SD with his reverse bulldog for the win. Gorilla calls Hart a disturbing individual as they walk out together. It always makes me laugh. Fun little match here, thanks to Adonis' bumping and heat and Special Delivery's game, as always, and he hung in there with him. I could honestly watch Adonis work all day. And actually wish we got a bit more of this match. It was fine, but I'd like to see him like in longer bouts. Adonis keeps piling up wins as he shifts around the card looking for something to do. I went a half star on this, and again, I wish we got more of it because I really, really enjoy Adonis during this time. Went 6:51. How about you, Kelly?
Yeah, I love Adonis in any setting. Really, you talk about the Trudy suitcase. I think it's been written out of the story, basically, because I don't think they ever blew it off or gave an explanation to it or anything.
Well, they kind of hint. I mean, I guess we won't get too far into what he becomes, but don't they kind of hint that that's what it was at some point? Or no? Was that just kind of always the thought process, but not really proven?
I don't know. I think that's maybe kind of a rumor that fans kind of have made up subsequently and not anything that was ever really planned, but I'm not sure. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was just dropped.
Because I think it was on the, I think it's the, not the end all, but the Kayfabe Memories board where there's actually a thread about it. And I thought like relax was kind of keyword for like, you know, certain lifestyles in New York at the time, during that time period. So that was kind of that's what they took it to mean at that point. But again, there's a whole thread of Kayfabe Memories about it. I don't remember the details, but.
And it was also a reference to Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Relax. Right. And then that was this topical song from the time. Anyway, yeah, this match wasn't too much. A lot of stalling by Adonis, and he dominated for most of the match. And then, we get the what is essentially a DDT, but hasn't been named as such yet. It's the finish. Gorilla calls a reverse bulldog, like you said. I went a star and a half. I'm just new to star rating, so maybe I have to work things out a bit. Maybe I'm grading on a curve for the evening, because we don't get too many matches better than this one.
Right. Yeah, I mean, looking back, maybe I would have went a star on it. Because I really like Adonis, but it was a little too short, and it never really got cooking too much.
Yeah,
but.
No.
Yeah, I thought it was a little sloppy. It didn't have as much of a flow as I thought it would. The one other thing that comes out of this, that I think it was the first time. Normally, back in this day, depending on where they were, or whatever, S.T. Jones was either hailed from Philadelphia or Antigua in the West Indies. Tonight, on this night, he was brought in as both. He said, yeah, from Antigua in the West Indies, but now living in Philadelphia, which I think is a first. I don't think we've ever heard S.D. Jones actually from both places. But, right. There was nothing much to do here. They took forever to get going. Even Gorilla. And Gorilla was the best at just over-dramatizing time, probably, which is where I used to get it early on in this history of the show. When he, the match is maybe a minute old, and Gorilla would go, "Wow, this match hasn't started yet. We're already 6 or 7 minutes in." It was like probably what, a minute and a half, probably. But it's just really sloppy. But I love Adonis, and I know I had said, it was more with the missing link, but I felt like Adonis fit with Bobby. I, at the time, I was not a fan of this managerial switch to Jimmy, because I thought Adonis for some reason kind of fit Bobby's mold.
Yeah.
So I was a little perplexed at the time why they switched to Jimmy, but little do we realize why. But I don't know. I thought he worked with Bobby fairly well, but such is life. And he's got a new manager, and he wins this match. JR gave you the time, and I'll give it a half star. It served its purpose, but I don't know. Talking about the jobber workers tonight, I was just expecting more out of SD than there was, but.
What do you think, Kelly, as far as Adonis and Heenan? Did you think he was a good fit with Heenan at this point? Would you have kept them together?
I guess he was. Heenan's a good fit with, or most guys are a good fit with Heenan, I guess I should say. But he's also good, of course, when he goes full on with the adorable Adrian gimmick with Jimmy Hart. I think that's a perfect pairing. It could have went both ways.
I don't know. It's just each manager in the company at the time kind of had a different style of managing. And I feel like Adonis fit with Bobby. Jimmy Hart had guys that were a little different, although, I guess time tells there. But, like Johnny, Luscious John had his type of guy, and Fuji had his type. Like Fuji had the mysterious, weird guys and Morocco. And then you had I just brain farted. I had another manager in my head and I lost it. Those guys had their certain type of, Freddie Blassie. He had like had all the foreign guys.
Yeah.
Each manager had like a different style of guy they had in their group. And I always felt like, even though he was a little rugged, he wasn't as, elegant. Not that King Kong Bundy's elegant, but he didn't have that kind of upper
very
end.
Elegant man. King Kong Bundy. That's what I think of. I think of King Kong Bundy, elegance.
Lots of elegance going around. No, but they were like a high-level bunch of guys who loved money, whereas, Jimmy Hart had the weird, effervescent kind of guys.
Right.
Freddie Blassie had the foreigners. Luscious John had like the scrappy, like I always thought, Luscious Johnny, I think would have been a good Adonis manager too.
Yeah.
But in any event, Adonis gets the win. Next up, a tag match. Once again, I saw these four on paper and I thought, this might actually be a pretty fun match. And we already mentioned this team once because they wrestled together two nights earlier in that downpour in San Juan. What do we got, JR?
We do have Iron Mike Sharp and Barry O, Dream Team here, taking on Mike Rotundo and Tony Atlas, of course. Tony Atlas is subbing for Barry Windham tonight. As we mentioned
and
last
forever.
Time, Scott, it was about it for Barry. We saw him, we saw him back on Saturday's Main Event with the patch on his eye. And as we said, he wouldn't make it to our next show. So the sad demise of the U.S. Express on display here, having dropped their titles and split when Barry left, leaving Rotundo to roam around with various partners. Sharp and Barry O, a bit of a jobber dream team in this era, and Kelly, you can wax on that in a bit. Rotundo teaming with Atlas keeps the USA gimmick alive and also fulfills Atlas's longtime wish to find a tag partner. Remember, he's been talking about that for a while, through the commentators and everything, so finally gets his wish fulfilled. Rotundo and Atlas entered to Real American. It doesn't get much of a pop. It's such so different without Wyndham there. So it's just like immediate. I know that's obvious, but it's so like it like Rotundo just feels like a bum like right out of the gate without Wyndham there. Rotundo and Barry open up with Rotundo dodging around Barry and working the arm. Barry escapes and tags Sharp and walks right into an armbar as well. Barry able to hook Rotundo from the apron, but Mike ducked and Sharp hammered his teammate by accident. Sharp and Barry O argue outside, but when they calm down and hug, we get back underway. Sharp overpowers Rotundo as he comes back in, and Rotundo comes back with a crossbody block for two. Atlas tags in and levels Sharp with a headbutt, and then wipes out both opponents before headbutting Sharp's groin to a pop. Atlas continues to work over Sharp as Jesse comments how hard Atlas's head is. There you go, two for two. Sharp bails out to regroup with Barry O and then comes in and offers a handshake, which Atlas obliges and then squeezes Sharp's hand. Rotundo tags in and goes to front face lock, but Sharp works free and is able to make the tag. Barry comes back in with a snapmare and stomps on Rotundo's nose before dropping him with a running power slam for a close near fall. Barry grabs the front face lock, but Rotundo powers out with an inverted atomic drop and tags in Atlas, and they both crack Barry with back elbows, and then Atlas overpowers Barry, spiking him with a sloppy pile driver and hooking him in with a tight bear hug. Barry gets out of the hold and tags in Sharp, who runs into a bear hug as well. Gorilla states that Wayne Gretzky may take issue with Sharp's claim, as Iron Mike says, of course, he's Canada's greatest athlete. Leans way back into the ropes to force the break. Rotundo tags back in and buries Sharp with a dropkick for two, but Sharp comes back with a head scissors. Rotundo breaks free into two trade blows, but Rotundo gets caught in the corner and worked over by both men. Barry tags in and hammers away before grabbing a front face lock, grinding Rotundo to the mat, but Rotundo fights his way to a tag. But the referee was, of course, tied up and didn't allow it. Sharp tags back in and takes over on the face lock until Rotundo fights free and makes a comeback. But Sharp buries a right hand to the gut to cut him off as Jesse just rips Rotundo for not trying to tag out. Sharp eats knees on a splash attempt, but now Rotundo tries to tag after a high knee, but Sharp barely makes a save on a dive. Jesse says Atlas is yelling the only two words he knows, come on. Barry tags in and starts to work the leg, but Rotundo kicks Barry to the floor to block a figure four. Sharp comes in and grabs Rotundo, but Mike kicks him in the back of the head and finally makes the tag. Atlas cleans house before Barry loads him up, loading up Barry for a power slam, but Sharp comes in, punches him with Barry falling on top for a one count. Barry then goes to a chin lock and tags Sharp, but Atlas hits an atomic drop and starts to beat on both men. Rotundo comes in as everything breaks down with Barry getting knocked outside as Atlas headbutts Sharp for two. Sharp and Atlas get tangled into the heel corner, and then Barry jumps off the top and slugs Atlas from behind. Barry tags in but whiffs on a dropkick, allowing Atlas to make the tag. Rotundo comes in with a dropkick and airplane spin, which also took out an interfering Sharp. Rotundo eventually drops Barry and grabs the win. Barry and Sharp attack after the bell, but Rotundo and Atlas fend them off with Barry getting dumped on the announce table. And this gets good here, too. And that pisses off Jesse, because Barry kicked him in the head. Jesse stands up and starts just flipping out on Barry, saying he'll take him out. And Barry challenges Jesse to a match. And Jesse said, if you think Atlas was tough, wait until you step in a ring with him. I thought the start is shaky, but got revved up halfway through. I thought it was interesting to see multiple heat segments when you look at these teams, because I thought it'd be a squash early on. Rotundo and Atlas had decent chemistry, but it wasn't the same. And I actually thought, you know, get your you guys' take on this. I thought Rotundo should have been given a chance as a singles guy instead of being shoehorned back into a tag team. And I know he was kind of working out his dates, but maybe they could have found something in him. We saw that great match with Iron Sheik. Solid work for most of this, but lack of chemistry and heat held it back. The Jesse O confrontation, I thought, was the best part of the match, the hottest part of the match, I should say. I went two stars here. It was very, very, like, well worked, just from a very, you know, basic standpoint. I mean, they went... How long? I don't think 1645. So long match for these guys. Scott, what did you think of this one? I enjoyed it for what it was, but I definitely thought it went a little bit too long.
It probably definitely went too long, and there was a method to the format madness tonight, and we'll get to it later. It definitely would have been pretty. I think it would have been. I would have given it a half star if maybe it was about 4 minutes shorter. Because I don't know. I think I like the Sharp Barrio combo. I thought they worked well together. They're two solid in ring heels. I agree with you about Mike Rotundo, though. I don't think doing a new U.S. Express wouldn't have done anybody any favors. Not that they really were being promoted as such on this night. Maybe it was just they already had the match booked and they just needed another guy to go with Rotundo. But hearing Real American for somebody else is, except when they, you know, when a heel steals it, is really is really hilarious. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I love the Barry O Jesse jawjacking after. I wonder what that was about. I mean, very weird. Two heels jawing at each other. Would you consider Jesse kind of a half baby face or a tweener? Kelly, what did you think of that? Like, when you saw that, what were you thinking the premise of it was? Was it just something to add a match to the November house show? Or Do you think something was coming from that?
Yeah, well, I've read the results ahead, so I knew Barrio and Jesse do have a match at the next MSG show. I'm not sure why exactly, you know, two heels, Jesse not wrestling very often. It seems very random. But yeah, I didn't remember that until the end when they started brawling, that was what was going to come from it. But yeah, quite random. I think Rotundo actually goes away and then comes back and then does the second US Express with Spivey.
Okay.
I want to say, I don't think he's there continuously until the end of the second US Express. I'm pretty sure he goes. Yeah. I'm looking at, wrestlingdata.com. He leaves in January 86 and comes back in May 86. And that's when they do the second US Express.
Okay. So that makes sense then.
Yeah.
It just seemed like so long. Like, I had a feeling he was gone for a while, but I'm thinking to myself, all right, if they both were going to Crockett and Rotundo's here till, I mean, beginning of 87.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow. How many dates were there left? I mean, did Wyndham really screw them that bad? Wow. I mean, how many dates did he, I mean, 13 months of dates or something? That's crazy. Yeah. I never really wrapped my head around it until I'm realizing, you know, the show's in early 87. Wow.
So why did, do you have the insight or intel, Kelly, is exactly what happened with Wyndham, like why he walked? Like, I think I know the basics of it, but do you have the story? Like, have you?
Yeah, from what I've heard, he just couldn't handle the schedule. It was too much, you know, traveling coast to coast, all over the place, living in hotels, just airports, just nonstop travel. That got to a lot of guys who were used to the territory system, right? Where you know, some of the territories were bigger than others, but most of the time you could go home at the end of the night and you didn't have to be on the road, you know, nonstop. So that's why Wyndham went back. Plus, Wyndham was a big star, so he was going to get pushed hard wherever he went and make good money at the time. So it wasn't that big of a deal financially for him. Obviously, I guess Rotundo realized that he could make better money in the WWF, and that's why he went back, I'm just guessing. Going back to do a second US Express with a guy who was basically a clone of Barry Windham or a lookalike, not the best idea in retrospect. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that US Express really got over at all. That was, you know, Vince seemed to be obsessed with these half-assed remakes of bigger stars at the time, with Corporal Kirshner and Spivey and a few others. C.V. Hoffe, more famously later, as a ripoff of Jimmy Snuka, and they just all sank like a stone. But yeah. Anyway, maybe I'll get into the match now. Yeah, this was okay. At first, you know, you mentioned the Jobber Dream Team and everything. When it was just Barry O and Mike Sharp in the ring, I was afraid that, oh, shit, it's going to be a match between those two guys.
Oh, God, I know, right? On this card, it would have been surprising.
No, it wouldn't have been surprising at all. So I was pleased when Rotundo and Atlas came out. Real American took a while to kick in. They were about halfway to the ring before it finally started playing. Yeah, and I don't think, Hogan must pick it up pretty quickly after this, I think, because there would have been no US Express for it to be used going forward. An interesting note from this that I picked up halfway through the match is that the son of Mike Rotundo, Bray Wyatt, is going to be taking on the nephew of Barry O, Randy Orton, at WrestleMania.
There you go,
year.
Fun fact.
There you go, yeah.
It all comes back around to this hot house show team right here.
Yeah,
and who's Iron Mike? And who's Iron Mike Sharp's son facing?
Yeah,
the money under Tony Atlas's mattress. There you go.
Tony Atlas's daughter, yeah, or something like that. Yeah, there was. I mean, Rotundo's great as a face in peril, actually, and that was the best part of this match. And at the end, though, there was a near botched body slam where he almost dropped. Rotundo almost dropped Barry O on his head. But Gorilla called it nicely executed, nonetheless. I went a star and a half with this one.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought it was solid, maybe a little too long. But I couldn't think if there was another babyface. Maybe the guy in this next match, maybe he could have swapped it out, because I think the guy in this next match with Mike Rotundo might have been actually a pretty awesome team, in my opinion. And speaking of our next match, JR, who do we have?
Well, our next match, sir, like we mentioned earlier, was a new debut, and that is, of course, King Tonga taking on Ron Shaw. A couple of new faces here. Let's start with King Tonga. Tonga Fafita grew up on the main island of South Pacific Island Kingdom, Tonga. At the age of 14, he was part of a group of teenagers sent to Japan to study and learn sumo. Sione Vahili, who would later wrestle under the name Barbarian, of course, was also part of this group of teams. I've definitely butchered his last name, huh? Vahali? I'm going to say Vahili.
Vahili.
I was thinking of Kenny Loggins. He remained in Japan for 2 years until the stable master that had recruited him passed away. Joined All Japan Pro Wrestling, where he was trained by Giant Baba. In the early 80s, he took the name King Tonga when he wrestled in Canada for the International Wrestling Promotion. Also wrestled in Puerto Rico in the WWC, where he won several titles, including the WWC North American Tag Team titles with El Gran Apollo, the WWC World Tag Team Championship with Hercules Hernandez, and the WWC Puerto Rico Heavyweight title. And he is taking on, as I mentioned, the man who graduated from high school in Philadelphia, Ron Shaw, tried different trades, including construction and truck driving, before he settled on any particular career. At the age of 23, joined Killer Kowalski's wrestling school. After 16 weeks at the school, Shaw asked Kowalski if he'd pass his name along to Dodea for consideration. A couple of weeks later, he got a call from Gorilla Monsoon to work a show. This would be the beginning of his career at WWF. Shaw would be used as enhancement talent. The biggest win of his career would occur 1 month from our event at Philadelphia on November 22nd, when he pulled an upset victory over David Sammartino via submission. Sammartino would later admit to throwing the match due to politics going on. During the 1990s, Shaw...
He really threw his ass into that match.
Nice. Shaw worked for independent promotions before hanging up his boots in 2000. Kelly, anything else about Ron Shaw here in that Sammartino story?
I've seen that match years ago on YouTube, and yeah, it's weird because Sammartino's in a bear hug, you know, it's midway through the match and he just submits, and then, you know, Gorilla's on commentary and he's acting like, oh no, there must be a mistake. Sammartino would never submit. He would never give up. And it's all very awkward feeling. I would recommend checking it out because it's a strange wrestling match. I don't know if Sammartino shoot quit for some reason, but I don't understand the reasoning behind it all. But I do know David by that time was not really in the best spot in his life, so it maybe makes sense there. It's strange, very strange.
All right, let's get into the match here. We have a new pair of faces, as we mentioned. Jabba Ron Shaw making his first appearance, King Tonga. Jesse's still fired up and ripping Barry O as we start this match. He is all ready to go. Gorilla puts over Tonga's ceremonial attire as he disrobes and gets underway. We actually get a handshake between the two, followed by some stalling by Shaw. Tonga opens up with a side headlock and buries Shaw with a shoulder block before taking him into a side headlock to the mat. Shaw fights to his feet, but Tonga takes him right back down and goes to a headlock again. Tonga releases the hold and hammers away until Shaw heads back to the apron and baits Tonga in, allowing him to yank him throat first across the top rope. Shaw comes back and tries to run Tonga to the buckle, but Tonga wants no part of that and fires right back up. Shaw tries to go to the arm, but Tonga reverses it with a whip and comes up empty at a hard charge. Shaw goes to work with some forearms before hooking a reverse chin lock, but Tonga goes to the eyes to force Shaw away. Shaw comes back with an awful standing dropkick that barely budged Tonga. Tonga shows him how it's done with a nice version, and it punches away as Shaw gets tied up in the ropes. Shaw works free and leverages Tonga to the floor to give him a chance to regroup, but then Tonga yanks Shaw to the mat and crotches him into the ring post. Back inside, Tonga hits a flying headbutt for two and then a crescent kick for the win. I thought this was sloppy and plodding. I thought Shaw sucked. Tonga was doing whatever he could to keep things together, but it's basically a squash outside of some meandering offense from Shaw. A pure dud on this one, Kelly. What'd you think?
Yes, I agree. Big dud. I don't know. Maybe it was because this, you know, there hasn't been anything to really get excited about by this point in the card. I mean, it was starting to wear on me a bit, but I really dislike this one. There was no heat. Boring chants, which were not uncommon this evening, that's for sure. Boos, like just boos at the action or lack thereof. The crowd just really shit on this match. There was just nothing going on. My last note is it ended mercifully. yeah, No, bad, very bad match.
Yeah, not good at all. And it's too bad because Tonga, you know, we know what he becomes and how good he can be.
Yeah.
Like, to see it like this was just like, oh, God.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's got, you know, a lot of career highlights. This is one, though, that will remain buried forever, hopefully.
Along with Steve Gerderwolf.
But, but you see, if King Tonga had come out to this, the match would have been that much better. I think that's what they were sumoing to, right here. There you go.
Just flying over, listening to Loggins and Messina.
There you go. Sione Vahevala! All right. That's about as exciting as this. My comments will be on this match. Really, 14 minutes? 14 minutes this had to be? Absolutely not. And, I mean, I had changed screens at work while I was watching the show today, and I heard Gorilla utterly destroying the refs, and I thought, oh, it must be Gil Roman, because that's the only referee that he freaking murders every week, and it was some other old guy. But, Jesse, I also noticed so far, other than the Barry O part, I feel like Jesse's definitely much more subdued here than in September. I feel like he's not talking as much, except once the Barry O stuff fired up. And I felt like he was really quiet in this match, too. But it was still – it wouldn't have helped. The match was still not that good.
He kind of picks his spots at this part. You know what I mean? He kind of lets Gorilla feed him, and then he comes in and –
yes, that's true.
Gives his points. Yeah, he's been different on pay-per-view. Like, he was different at Mania, and even Saturday's main event with Vince. He seems more aggressive with Vince. With Gorilla, he seems to defer a bit and kind of work his way in where he can. I don't know if it was just a reverence thing or just, you know, whatever, him and Vince. Vince told him to be more adversarial. I'm not sure, but –
yeah, it must be a respect thing. He doesn't throw Jesse chews Vince to pieces, whereas with Gorilla, Jesse chews the baby faces in the ring to pieces and kind of, you know, goofs a Gorilla about his joy juice and his heavy gambling habits. But for the most part, it's definitely Jesse defers to ripping the baby faces more than he does his commentating partner.
Mm-hmm.
But this match should have been commentated better, maybe it would have saved it, but it really didn't. I give this half a star. It's not very good.
Jesus Christ. that is generous.
I'm going to be generous with a half star. So,
Kelly, what did you think of Jesse with Gorilla versus Vince at this point? We know where it heads, but right now at this point, where he's with Vince on Saturday Night Van, and I think, you know, some TVs here and there or whatever, but versus what he's doing with Gorilla on these shows.
Yeah, well, I think Scott made a great point on how there is a different Jesse with Vince and then with Gorilla. Tonight, though, I think he was just plain bored. Look what he's got to work with in the ring. It's just not very exciting at all. It's interesting that he had a different style with Gorilla. I guess it wouldn't work, you know, him browbeating Gorilla so much as it would with Vince. Vince, when he was just the announcer and was pretending not to own the company or whatever, what came off kind of like a wussy, and then everyone sort of, you know, perceived him that way. I know my friends and myself did watching, because we were so shocked eventually when he turned heel and did the whole Mr. McMahon thing. It was such a, you know, 180 degree change in personality for him. So it made sense that Jesse sort of treated him that way. That's for sure.
The reverence that Gorilla has for Jesse is, or Jesse has for Gorilla, is 10 times better than the reverence any of the three of us have for this match. So let's just move on from it.
Yeah.
Next up, we have probably one of our, co-main event. There's really only two main event level matches tonight. Mm. This one is a big one. And I have to say, JR, I'm a little disappointed because usually the WWF is pretty good about creative names for things.
I think you skipped the match here because there's no way you're talking about what the actual next match was.
No, I don't think I skipped it. Did I skip a match? I don't think I did. Let me see. Oh yeah, I did forget to write this match. My bad. Yes,
unless you consider this one of the main, which is possible on this card, honestly.
In New York.
No, I actually, believe it or not, I actually forgot to write. I actually forgot to. I have notes on this match, but I actually forgot to put a header on it. So no, this is not the match I'm talking about. We will save that. This match is a main event anywhere in Puerto Rico.
There you go.
Which is really what Gorilla should have said. All right, what do we have here?
Well, I have a secret for you. This is actually one of my favorite matches of the night. That is Pedro Morales taking on Rene Goulet, two whipping boys of ours here on this show. We've given Goulet some credit, I guess. But Morales has been, ever since Parv was on with us, has been kind of our whipping horse. But Pedro back in the house, again working his way up back up through the card, this time against a steady old veteran, Rene Goulet. Pedro gets a warm welcome, comes in fired up as Goulet bails to the floor. Goulet has a brand new glove. Jesse says he's looking good. Gorilla asks Jesse if he's completed his mission and found out any info about Relaxa Trudy, but Jesse says he's come up empty so far and reminds us that Trudy was not here tonight. So maybe that's the official burial right there, Kelly. Maybe that's put it to bed.
Yeah, maybe.
After a bunch of stalling, we get a lockup and one by Pedro, who punches away. They trade some holds and counters on the mat until Pedro backs things up, or brings things back up to his feet. Pedro drills Goulet with a shoulder block and then goes to a side headlock, which Goulet turns into a couple of rollover pin attempts, pissing off Gorilla, who says those aren't legit attempts and they'll never work. God, Gorilla, give it a rest. Goulet pushes to his feet and tries to find a way out of the hold, but he eventually does break free and knocks Pedro hard to the floor. Morales slams his leg into a chair on his way out of the ring. Pedro drags himself up, but Goulet meets him and bites his forehead and then slings him hard into the post shoulder first. Pedro careens into the announce table, where Goulet files over and stomps away. Goulet aggressively keeps Morales out of the ring and then heads outside as well, slinging Morales hard into the barricade. The bell rings by accident as Goulet teases a dive off the top rope, but the referee talks him down. Morales fights to the apron again, but Goulet keeps kicking away until he falls to the floor. Morales finally makes it back in, but Goulet goes right to the scorpion claw hold. Morales eventually fights to his feet and breaks the hold with an inverted atomic drop. Goulet pops up and goes right to the attack, slamming Pedro down and stomping on him for two. Goulet heads up top and misses a big splash, allowing Pedro to recover, and then tosses Goulet to the floor. Pedro follows him out and spikes him hard into the barricade and announce table, leaving him for dead. Goulet fights his way back to the apron, but Pedro meets him and runs him into the top buckle and then brings him back in and slings him hard into the opposite corner, ending with Goulet crotching himself across the top rope. Pedro gets two on a backdrop and reverses a Goulet suplex into an inside cradle for the win. Both guys feel so fucking outdated, but they figured it out in this match. I thought they put it together and delivered something pretty fun. All the stuff with Goulet punishing Pedro on the floor is really good. I thought Rene's aggression was shocking. We usually don't see him working like that, you know, manically. Pedro selling on some of the bumps were really good. He had a nice comeback, getting his revenge on the floor. I thought this would be boring and a slog, but I was entertained and enjoyed it. Now, fair enough that it could be, because the rest of the show has been so fucking awful that it stood out having two veterans that kind of knew how to put a match together. But I thought they had good energy. I thought they worked a better pace than you would expect. And I liked Goulet being like really fired up and aggressive. I went 2 stars on this. Scott, how about you?
My apologies. I had two matches notes mushed together. Yeah. The 14 minute match was this one, not the other one. Bad notes. Well, I'm not the only one apparently. I think that, this match did have actually a pretty good flow to it. I mean, I know we've kind of bashed Pedro this year, but, and then, yeah, they're dated. JR, I agree, but at least with the two of them, and this might be a reason why they were together here. They had to eat up some time in this match. And I do think that if you put two guys together from a similar era, and give them a decent amount of time, you'll tell a pretty good story. Sure. The crowd has evolved a little bit. You know, this isn't kind of that older, you know, 1973 crowd, but they still probably would appreciate a good 12, 13, 14 minute match if worked properly and told a good story. And it probably is the best we've seen of Pedro Morales. I mean, I don't know how long Pedro Morales was on hiatus before he came back earlier in the year.
What was it, Kelly? Maybe a couple of years?
Yeah, a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure at this point he's probably got the rust off. I'm sure he had.
Well, his last match wasn't bad either, wasn't it? Was that the one you were on, Kelly, for that house show? Or there was one recently where he wasn't as bad.
Yes. Yes, against Barry O, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. That one wasn't bad. This one was the best he's been, though.
Yeah, he's definitely shaken off the cobwebs, no pun intended, you know, out of the closet, you know, in the old home. And I mean it's fine. And it's Rene Goulet and the disgusting racquetball glove, which Gorilla Jesse really didn't care about. that's a Gorilla joke that him and Mean Gene liked earlier in the year. Jesse really didn't care about the stupid glove. So, and the match is solid enough. Again, I don't know if we needed 14 minutes of it, but at least it's two guys who could tell a decent story in 14 minutes, if need be. But I definitely think that Goulet still a serviceable guy, and obviously Pedro's Pedro, and I think he shook off the rust. Kelly, did he have rust?
Yeah. Well.
Was he Rusty Brooks?
I would argue that Pedro's been rusty since about 1980. by this point, and he never really shook it off. Oh, that's not fair. No, he had actually several good matches during his IC title or multiple IC title runs, but most of the time though, he was content to sit in headlocks, front face locks. This has been discussed plenty. Here, this was okay. I like the King of the Mountain spot with Goulet keeping him out of the ring. That was good. That was gritty. But there were boring chants, and it was, you know, this was a sad day for someone like Pedro Morales, who once headlined the Garden, you know, 30 times or so, and was the champ and a big star, and he's getting boring chants. It's sad to see. And then at the end, the ending was kind of sloppy and botched, just before the small package, which Pedro pretty much used in every match for the win. At this point, he became the king of the small package. Before
Daniel the fundamentals, Bryan. Kelly. Bryan, you got to learn the fundamentals.
Oh yeah, don't get me wrong. I love me a good small package.
That's a funny move to hang your hat on, though.
But yeah, he I don't know. Maybe he couldn't get turned
over. Way too many Titans jokes here. Hangings, small packages.
Yes, Johnny would be having a field day.
I was trying to do the Johnny voice, but there's only one Johnny voice. So.
Yeah. I've seen too many Pedro matches by now. I'm numb to the guy. I think I don't want to see any more. So I went one star on this, mostly for the King of the Mountain spot in the middle, which actually was focused, and the rest of the match I thought was the shit. So.
Yeah, but that's like, I mean, one star is like six. On
the Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right? It's pretty high.
What's up with the fucking bell ringing, by the way? This is like the fourth show I feel like we've had an inadvertent bell ring during a match at MSG. Is the guy like, is he falling asleep over there? And is it Mel Phillips or whoever just falls asleep and dings the bell? Do they think the finish is coming and he fucks up? Like, I feel like at least half the shows we've watched has been an inadvertent bell ring.
Yeah, right. I agree.
I wondered about this for years, and it's always at MSG, and I think it's because they put the bell on a seat, on a chair, and then it occasionally will get knocked off when guys getting spilled out. Yeah, I think that's why it rings accidentally, is because it falls off the chair.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. I think that's what it is, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tables are too small. So, all right, Pedro wins in 14:03, probably about 6 minutes too long, but not bad. Not bad, though. Could have been worse. All right, now to the match that is the co-main event. Maybe it's a tri-main event because I think that tag with Barrio and Iron Mike Sharp deserved co. no, not really. So again, as I was saying before, that WWF is usually good about coming up with snazzy names for things, but the name for this match seems very AWA-ish because I feel like they didn't really do a lot of forethought or creativity into naming this match, but it could have been better. Could have been better. Sounds very AWA-ish. But what do we have, JR? What is it? What is our first of the two big main events tonight?
It is the double Colossal Jostle. Of course, the rematch from the Colossal Jostle, which we saw between Andre the Giant and King Kong Bundy. And now it is a tag team match with King Kong Bundy and his friend Big John Studd. Andre the Giant teaming up with Hillbilly Jim back in action. Of course, have been out for a while with that messed up leg. But here he is, and it's an interesting spot for Hillbilly because it kind of seemed like maybe he'd be de-pushed a bit while he was hurt. But here he is getting inserted into a pretty big spot. Great heat on the Heenan crew. Heel presence is just tremendous for those three. Mm-hmm. Of course, the fat sloppy pig himself, Captain Lou Albano, leads out Andre the Giant, Hillbilly Jim, to a big pop as Don't Go Messing with a Country Boy plays. Nice spot for Hillbilly here, getting him back in the main event mix. He really could have been derailed by that leg injury, but they're giving him another go. Andre goes right at Stud before the bell triggers a heated brawl that the crowd just ate up. Stud and Bundy retreat as things settle down. Stud heads in, and Andre starts going right to work, clubbing him and shooting him hard into Hillbilly Jim's boot, causing Stud to bail again. Both Bundy and Stud try to ambush Andre, but Giant fights them off and almost slams Stud. Andre keeps working over Stud and then slams him in the middle of the ring to a mega pop. The Garden keeps erupting as Andre just buries him with a headbutt. Jesse says Andre's trying to do this all himself, which could be a mistake. But Reza says it. Andre tags in Jim. Jim almost slams Stud as well, but John blocks it by grabbing the ropes. Jim punches away until Stud breaks free and makes the tag. Gorilla reminds us that Bundy has squashed the ribs of Hillbilly Jim not that long ago. Bundy elbows Jim down and whiffs on a splash. Jim tries to trip Bundy up and stomps on his gut before the two big men
locked up into a test of strength. Bundy buries a knee to Jim's gut to break that up and then shoves him into the corner and tags in Stud, who shoots Jim across the ring and runs into a boot. Jim tags in Andre, who stalks Stud and lays him into a headbutt. Andre ducked his head for a backdrop, which allowed Stud to kick him in the face and make the tag. Bundy and Stud would then work him over with kicks until Bundy grabbed a front face lock to keep Andre on the mat. Stud and Bundy kept him grounded, trapped in their corner, and worked him over with heavy blows. Andre eventually powered up and choked away at Bundy with his own shoulder straps, and then Andre was able to dodge a charging Bundy, who slammed hard into Stud instead. Andre couldn't tag in time, though, allowing Bundy to go back to work on the sternum before tagging Stud, who worked over the arm. Andre punched and kicked free and then punched away in the corner before getting a pair of scissors from Albano. Of course, he wanted to cut Stud's hair. Bundy makes a save, but Andre fends him off and then was finally able to cut some of Stud's hair for revenge. Bundy again makes a save with a heavy shot as the referee has just totally lost control. Jesse's demanding a disqualification as Stud comes off the ropes with a shot to the kidney. After some more strikes, Stud tags out, but Bundy walks right into a flurry of punches from Andre, who then went for a splash, but Heenan hooks his leg to block him. Andre takes a swipe at Heenan, but Stud made the save. Albano comes over, but Bobby shoves him to the steps as all hell breaks loose in the ring, leading to a double disqualification. Team Heenan eventually gets cleared from the ring after a hot assault from Bundy on Bundy by Jim. I thought it was another fun installment of this feud. I thought it was a good showing for Hilly Jim. It felt like he belonged. He didn't really feel over his skis at all. I thought the crowd loved every second of it. It was great that Andre got the slam and the haircut, but not the win. So he gets a win of sorts because he gets the haircut slam revenge, but of course doesn't win the match, so the feud can keep going. I also thought it was interesting that Andre kind of played face in peril for this one. Yeah. Not Hillbilly. That always surprises me. He is good at seller, I mean, but it's just surprising they'd make him look kind of weakened. I went 2.5 on this, Kelly. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that was the same rating I have. I thought it was a fun match, and, you know, coming after all the crap, we finally get something with the heat that the crowd is into. And like batshit crazy crowd. Andre slamming Stud early was surprising, and that got a huge pop. And the crowd, yeah, like you mentioned, just lapping everything up. And like you said, Andre playing face in peril is super rare. I don't know if that speaks to, like, Hillbilly not being trusted to do much right, of anything at all.
Well, I didn't know too if it was I just assume because of the feud has been going so long, yeah. They kind of had to get a little heat on him, and they had the Bruce Sternum to work off of. So I just figured they wanted to establish Bundy and Stud as tough enough to control him, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's right on. I think that's a good point. And it worked, you know. Andre was decent there. I mean, you can tell he's obviously in a lot of pain and a shell of his former self in a lot of ways. But he could still go enough to get through a match like this. The scissors getting introduced, I had shades of like, well, what's going to happen? Like, obviously, I knew it wasn't going to be like Abdullah the Butcher and we're going to have a bloodbath all of a sudden, but still having the scissors in the ring added, you know, a sense of danger to the match.
For sure.
All of a sudden.
I think it's cool, too, that he's still, like, holding on to that. Like, they're not letting that fade. Because, you know, it's kind of been forgotten because Patera left, and they haven't talked much about the haircut stuff, but it was cool that Andre's, like, still so angry and focused on getting his head shaved that, you know, he's looking for that revenge show. Like, slamming Stud isn't enough. He still wants to cut his hair.
Yeah, and he got some of the haircut. I mean, the feud between him and Stud started in early 1983, and there was a few breaks, but It's almost 1986 and these guys are still feuding. It's crazy. I mean, and then this was a perfect setup for the next month where you'd get the managers involved and have a six man. So you didn't have anything decisive here. I like the brawl between Bobby and Albano on the outside. It was nice to see two legendary managers mix it up.
Yes, that was good.
Yeah, cool spot. Yeah, like I said, great heat. I mean, but really there was no real like substance underneath all the bells and whistles. I mean, it was a great, you know, smoke and mirrors match. This was just carried by the personalities and the heat and the angle. And you really didn't have to do much. And I love those kind of matches because it's beautiful. You get guys who have to bust their ass and go through tables and jump off cages and do all this crazy shit for hardly any reaction. And these guys barely have to lift a finger and they got the crowd in the palm of their hand. I think that's awesome. That's great pro wrestling right there.
Uh, This match may have saved the show from maybe being the worst house show in the history of this building. But I just finally realized, I mean, I know JR and I are not the biggest fans of hillbillies in general. They dirty up this world. But Hillbilly Jim is fucking terrible. He is terrible. And there were a couple of times where he was trying to get shots in. I think it was on Stud. And he just looked so awkward and so clumsy. So I got to be honest with you, Kelly. I think Andre had to be the face in peril, or this match would have been a fucking disaster. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
No, you're probably right.
It's an absolute mess. And I love Bundy and Stud. I've gained a huge amount of respect for them as an awesome big man tag team. I love that they're Bobby's guys. They talk about them a lot as I'm watching these prime times in 86. Awesome team. And it was a mess. I mean, this was a mess. But I'll give it a star and a half because Andre is still that damn good and he is still the boss. And that guy will still sell. I mean, yeah, he's not moving. I mean, he threw himself around a decent amount in this match, but it's obvious that things are slowly starting to, affect him. But I'd say something, JR, Bundy continues to have a pretty good 85. I mean, he's every month is once again, he comes up, steps up, has a great match.
Yeah.
I'm a big Stud guy. I love Stud. So I'll give it a star and a half, but Hillbilly Jim is putrid. He's absolutely putrid. And so I don't think there's a thimble of work rate anywhere in that disgusting, smelly, pig-infested family. And it's just so bad. It really ruined what would have been who else could you have put there? You know what's funny? I can't wait about to say this. JR's going to hit me in the back of the head. I would have put Uncle Elmer here.
Oh, God. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Seriously, why not?
What's wrong with Hillbilly?
At least he's got an excuse to not move. He's fucking 400 pounds of old fat fuck. But at least he kind of fits that whole big, big thing. Hillbilly Jim was supposed to come off as the Superman, and he looked like a bumbling idiot.
I don't think so. He was a big, tall guy. I thought he looked fine out there. I thought he looked good.
Cousin Junior and Cousin Luke could have worked together. And maybe each could have wore one boot. No, I'm going off the rails. In any event, I just thought he was terrible. But Andre's still Andre. He's awesome. Bundy and Stud are great, and they still make this a very good, mid-show main event. But I'm going to ask it now, Kelly, because we'll already say that we're not going to see him here. Yeah. And JR and I kind of talked about this on the September house show, but where the fuck is Hogan?
Well, yeah.
Since June.
Yeah, I know it has been, and he won't be back.
I understand. I understand it's the Garden.
Yeah.
I understand. I get the business part of it. I do get it. But still, it's been four months.
1 week since
since Uncle Elmer. But no. It's just, it's ludicrous. We have not, that this building, the building, has not seen its world champion since June. It's no sense at all. Where was he? Let me go to Graham's sighting. Let me see where he was on the 20th. Was he at either of these shows? On the 20th, one show, Hogan fought Jesse in Hartford. He was only in Hartford the night before. You're telling me he couldn't do – why not put Hogan and Andre against Stud and Bundy? They just wrestled on Science Main Event.
Well,
why not have
them
here?
They haven't yet.
Oh, it's coming up.
Yeah.
But it's coming up.
But that's why they did there, I think. They probably didn't want
to – alluded on that Science Main Event. I'm sorry, you're right. They alluded to it.
Yeah.
So why don't you just do it here as a taste test for the Science Main Event? Coming up.
I didn't mind Hillbilly. I don't know. I thought
he was
fine.
I didn't either. I think, Scott, you're prejudiced against Hillbilly country folk. I mean, I'm not a big fan of him either. But as for Hogan, it is strange because he won't wrestle at MSG again until December. So that's a long break. And if you go back in history, like Bruno never missed an MSG show as champ. Backlund never missed an MSG show as champ. Pedro, of course. Superstar Graham.
The whole publicity tour thing. And we'll lead to more of this story over the next few vaults. But let me see. Was he at this taping in Poughkeepsie? The next night, Junkyard Dog. He fought Rusty Brooks.
I've seen that match, I think.
Okay, so we're talking about – he probably was wearing a blue all, which usually doesn't wrestle at the top jobbers.
That match was on a tape, wasn't it? That Hogan Rusty Brooks was on the Hulkamania tape.
It's on something. Yeah, I think it is.
Graham doesn't have it connected to anything, but
I think it was on like one of the original Hulkamania tapes or something. I remember seeing that on the tape.
It's actually on the Savage Elizabeth Coliseum videotape.
It's definitely on one of the Hogan ones too. I think
Hogan WWF World Champion Hulk Hogan pinned Rusty Brooks with the leg drop at the 36-second mark. With a body slam and a leg drop. Prior to the bout, Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth appeared ringside, with Savage having Elizabeth ask Hogan over the mic why the champion doesn't wrestle anymore with credentials. After the contest, Savage attacked Hogan, but Hogan quickly chased him from the ring. So, I mean, come on. It makes no sense. But we'll talk about this topic as time progresses.
I do have one theory as to why he wasn't booked at the Garden very often, and Meltzer's written about this before. How that Vince at first saw Hogan as more like an Andre the Giant type attraction, in that you couldn't run him in the same market every month because the crowd would eventually lose interest, and you had to treat him as a special attraction. So you'd only book him, you know, half the year, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something to that, because he had the other shows to wrestle at. He was even doing tours of Japan in 1985 still. But I think there's something to that theory that, and this may have been like his father before he passed away, some advice maybe he gave Vinny on how to book Hogan. Because I think you'll see this change as you get into 86, that Hogan becomes more of a regular at MSG. But yeah, I think there was a bit of that philosophy as far as booking Hogan. I think there's some truth to that.
I half agree with you. Hogan is a special attraction. He's also your world champion. And you can't have one house show at your biggest venue after another and not have your world champion. Here we have a card with no belts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Still drew 19,000. They were still drawing pretty well.
19,000, and the card is three-quarter shit. So, I mean, you know, I'm not discounting you, Kelly. Your point is correct. I only half agree with the theory that you can't treat your world champion like a special attraction. Your world champion is your world champion. Bob Backlund was not a special attraction. Bruno was not a special attraction. Bruno was the fucking face of the company. Hogan is the face of the company. And so 1 month, I could see. 2 months, all right, it's time now. 3 months, no. Now you're talking 4 months. It's just getting out of hand.
Yeah, and it's funny.
Hogan's not the kind of guy, my personal opinion, Hulk Hogan's not the kind of guy that gets that fans will tire out of. Now, I will say this. It's only been a year and a half since his reign, so it's not like we are thinking in hindsight, of course, but still, Andre's different because Andre always wrestled that schedule. As your world champion, you gotta be there at least every other month.
Yeah,
just my.
I think if you do look at some of the numbers, you will see when Hogan returned the next month, the numbers were definitely down from the first appearance in a lot of towns. But you'd have thought Hogan would have been kind of upset for missing out on all these MSG paydays, because that was...
He was probably still getting paid.
I mean, obviously...
He's got other things. I mean, I'm sure he's got
merchandise. No, I mean, I wouldn't shock me if they're still giving him, like, a cut of these houses.
He was getting a cut. Yeah, that's very possible, too.
Boy, I would have pissed.
I mean, who knows?
Because they may think, like, his name was so hot that the company was hot. You know, like, it wouldn't shock me if he was like, getting, like, a percentage of this shit anyway.
Oh, probably. No, I mean, he had such a favorable deal right from the get-go that, it wouldn't be surprising.
I mean, this Hartford Civic Center house show the night before is better than this one. Iron Mike Sharp beat SD Jones, Corporal Kirshner, well, Lieutenant Terry Gibbs, King Kong, Tito the Spoiler. Okay, here you go.
You want to start making your argument anytime next?
Morocco Steamboat. Morocco, don't talk about Spotty like that. Morocco Steamboat, Savage, Scott McGee. And Scott McGee was a serviceable guy.
Keep going. Keep going.
Heart Foundation, Killer Bees, and Hogan Jesse.
Yeah.
Hogan Jesse would have been a pretty big main event in 1985.
Yeah. Bees and Heart Foundation, come on. Bees and Heart Foundation
I don't think it's like substantially better than this card.
Again, we can discuss this more as
Hogan Jesse is a big draw, but I would argue the Double Colossal Jostle is pretty big too at this point.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
All right, why don't we put down the Hulk Hogan contract negotiations, and we'll take a break.
Who do you guys think Hogan's been?
Huh?
I'm kidding. So where do you think Hogan's been?
That's true. I know. Kelly, scale of 1 to 10, 0.75 so far. What do you think?
You don't want to spoil the ending, do you?
As of right now, I'd maybe, with the last match, it would maybe get now a 1, maybe a 2.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not good. No.
All right. When we come back, we will continue on. We got some interview segments. And then the thing that really is the main event of this show, and it's not even a match. And then we have a decent enough tag match in our main event, in our last match. All right. JR, Kelly, myself, more from the Garden after the break.
Think I'd just stay here and rain. Hey, listen close and you can hear.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only feed, and of course, the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is legendary ring announcer and WWE Hall of Famer, the Think, Howard Finkel, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. 'Cause the $1 million man
Nation, we are back taking a look at the October 1985 Madison Square Garden House Show. Of course, Kelly Nelson, our Freebird partner in the booth with us here tonight. If you missed the announcement on the last couple shows, Kelly will be joining us every, maybe once a month or so for these MSG House Show look backs. And I think it's a great addition, brings a great perspective. And he said, JR, Scott, take on me for the Place to Be podcast. And we said, Kelly, you're a great fit. And Scott, I think that transitions as well to our pop culture corner here this week, because Take on Me by Aha, as you hear under us, was the number one song in the land. Why don't you take us away on a nostalgia wave back to 1985?
That is right. Thank you very much. And we will begin. I want to thank our social media director, Mr. Jason Greenhouse, for helping us with our music. And yes, number one that week was a little Aha with Take on Me. Of course, the revolutionary video that was on MTV with the, you know, the stutter drawing, the black and white and the color. At number two, moving up the charts quickly, our girl Whitney with Saving All My Love for You. Number three, another Motown act, little Stevie Wonder with Part-Time Lover. Number four, dropping a spot, Ready for the World with Oh Sheila. Song moving up the ladder, up four spots, Jan Hammer and the theme to Miami Vice. Number six, Lonely Old Night by John Mellencamp, staying where it is. Moving down five spots, JR, slowly slipping down. Little Sting, little MTV, little Dire Straits, Money for Nothing. Not the last time we'll mention Dire Straits on our report this week. Number eight, Dancing in the Street, that duet with Mick Jagger and David Bowie. Number nine, a song I actually don't remember. Kelly, do you remember the song? I don't remember it. Fortress Around Your Heart by Sting. I don't really remember that song.
No.
I don't remember a lot of his solo stuff till the 90s. And at number 10, coming into the top 10, another hit for Tears for Fears, this time Head Over Heels.
Great song.
So there is your top 10, which came out 2 days before on October 19th, 1985. All right, let's go to the theater. And four movies came out on this day, JR. Nothing crazy. Not as good as we had the last show, but here we go. All right, this movie, I don't know if it made no money or if it's just not recorded based on the website that I look at, but I don't even know what... it doesn't even have a genre. Are you ready? Yeah. It is called Wild Geese 2. Sequel to the incredible anonymous movie Wild Geese.
All right, let's see here. A 1985 British action thriller film directed by Peter Hunt. Based on the 1982 novel The Square Circle, a group of mercenaries hired to spring Rudolf Hess from Spandau Prison in Berlin. Sequel to Wild Geese from 1978, produced by Yuan Lloyd, adapted from the novel by Carney. Actor Richard Burton, who starred in the film as Colonel Alan Faulkner, was planning to reprise his role but died days before filming. Sequel is Faulkner's brother, played by Edward Fox, as one of the mercenaries. So, stars Scott Glenn, Barbara Carrera, Edward Fox, Laurence Olivier, Robert Freitag, Kenneth Hagg, Stratford Johns, Derek Thompson, Robert Webber.
And Peter Hunt actually was a past James Bond director. He directed a James Bond film, 1969's On Your Majesty's Secret Service.
Budget was 11 right. million pounds.
Ah, well, according to this, it made no money, so that's fine. same thing. Pounds are worth shit. All right.
Sir Lawrence was in poor health during filming, had a nurse accompanying him during the entire production.
Yes, Sir Laurence Olivier, one of the greatest actors ever, but he was pretty old at that point. Next up, this made $151,627. So to be honest with you, it was not a stellar money-making week for movies. A thriller suspense film called The Holcroft Covenant. Sounds like a pay-per-view.
TNA pay-per-view.
Kelly and Pete doing commentary for The Holcroft Covenant. Yes. Oh. What you got backstage for us?
We're going to have a triple reverse battle royal here on TNA's Holcroft Covenant pay-per-view. Spy thriller, 1985 film based on the Robert Ludlum novel of the same name, starring Michael Caine, Anthony Andrews, Victoria Tennant, Lily Palmer, Mario Adorf, Michael Lonsdale, Bernard Hepton, Shane Rimmer, Alexander Kirst, Michael Wolff, Richard Munch.
Another Bond reference. Michael Lonsdale was the bad guy in Moonraker. So pretty
budget
British
of 8
reference.
Million pounds. Box office, $393,000. Yeah, James Caan originally cast as a lead, but walked off the set. I will forever be grateful to James Caan forever. So he gave me the best gift that's ever happened to me in my career. Michael Caine, that is the director, John Frankenheimer.
I don't blame him because it fucking probably sucked. So there you go. All right, number two that week made $153,764, a drama titled, The Quiet Earth. Sounds like a novel you'd have to read when you were a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, it was a novel. It turned into a film.
Yeah.
1985 New Zealand science fiction post-apocalyptic film directed by Jeff Murphy, starring Bruno Lawrence, Alison Rutledge, and Pete Smith as three survivors of a cataclysmic disaster. Science fiction novel by the same name. Kelly, sounds like you were familiar with it.
I think I was thinking of something else. Oh,
okay.
The Good Earth, that's what I was thinking.
Oh, okay. Pearl Box, Good Earth.
I'll say you heard of this New Zealand fucking film from 1985.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of New Zealand cyberpunk science fiction. Yeah.
July 5th begins as a normal winter morning near Hamilton, New Zealand, but at 6:12 a.m. the sun darkens for a moment, and a red light surrounded by darkness is briefly seen. Zach Hobson is a scientist working for Delenco, part of an international consortium working on Project Flashlight, an experiment to create a global energy grid. When he awakens abruptly, turns on the radio, is unable to receive any transmissions, gets dressed, and goes to the deserted city. Investigating a fire, discovers a wreckage of a jet, but no bodies, only empty seats. Enters his underground laboratory, A monitor displays the message, Project Flashlight Complete. The mask disappearance seems to coincide with the moment it was activated, and notes on its tape recorder, Zach Hobson, July 5th, there's been a malfunction in Project Flashlight with devastating results. It seems I'm the only person left on Earth.
Hmm. Okay. And the number one movie that weekend, a horror film, which made $2,023,000. I do actually remember this movie. It was called Reanimator. I do remember this movie. Pretty good, actually, for a good horror movie. Let's good see. Mid-80s Re-animator. Horror flick. Re-hyphen animator.
Film series? Were there more than one? Let's see. First one was 1985.
Yep.
Then 1990 and then 2003. H.P. Lovecraft's Reanimator, in 1985 American science fiction horror comedy film, loosely based on episodic novella Herbert West Reanimator. Let's see who was in this bad boy. We had Bruce Abbott, Barbara Crampton, David Gale, Robert Sampson, and Jeffrey Combs.
Jeffrey Combs. Oh, I know Jeffrey Combs, a Star Trek actor, Jeffrey Combs. All right, so there's your four movies that came out
this week.
What?
So week offering.
The week off. Yeah, I know. It was week offering this week, yes. End of the year, we'll, of course, we'll recap any that we've missed, but...
This was not weak this week. What number did you say this was? Number five?
This was number five this week.
This song was better than all four of those movies combined.
Yeah, pretty much. So,
end of card.
According to Kelly, so it was the Aha song. all right, let us go now. Baseball, it is an off day for the World Series. Speaking of course, Kelly, but as we all know, your beloved Toronto Blue Jays screwed the pooch, the 3-0 lead, screwed the duck, DuckTales, and screwed the ALCS, leading 3-1, and then lost 3 in a row to the Royals. Meanwhile, Ozzie Smith, who barely ever hits home runs, hit a home run to help beat the Dodgers in the NLCS, and the Cardinals actually took the first 2 games of the World Series in Kansas City. So today is the off day. Game 3 tomorrow in St. Louis with the Royals trailing 2-0.
I'm just glad Toronto lost. Fuck them.
Well, I wasn't a fan yet. But yeah, that was it's still talked about to this day as one of the most crushing defeats in franchise history.
All right, JR. It is week 7. Yes, it is week 7 of the NFL season, and I'm going to have our mystery ombudsman to my right, who we're not going to say who it is, but he's going to give me a thumbs up or thumbs down if he agrees with your game predictions of week 7 of the 1985 NFL season.
The mysterious ombudsman. I'm not a big fan of that at all. At all.
He's like the raw GM, except he brings more ratings. All right, the Bengals are at the Astrodome to take on the Oilers.
Bengals and the Astros take on the Oilers. That's a tough divisional tilt. I'm going to go with Houston at home.
You are correct. 44-27, even though you ripped Boomer Esiason, who actually was with the – we thought he was in college. He actually was on the Bengals.
No, we didn't think he was in college. You thought that incorrectly.
I thought he was in college. You thought he actually started, which he doesn't. But he must have started here. Kenny Anderson must have got hurt, but Boomer Esiason threw for 381 in the loss. The L.A. Raiders go into Cleveland to take on the Browns in the Dog Pound.
I will go with the Raiders.
The Raiders win by a point, 21-20, in the 2-0 to start. The Chargers go into the Metrodome to take on the Vikings.
We get the old Air Coryell offense, Dan Fouts coming in, but I think Minnesota holds serve at home.
The Vikings win, 21-17, Tommy Kramer, 311 yards. The Cowboys go into the Vet to take on the piece of trash Eagles.
Hey, my favorite NFL team.
There you go, in honor of Kelly and Brad, he's having a big week. I'm going to say the Eagles beat your stupid Cowboys.
They did. Fuck you.
Yeah.
16-14, Ron Jaworski threw for 380 yards and then cooked some wings at his restaurant at the hotel. The 49ers, your defending world champions, go to the Silverdome to play the Lions.
Yeah, I'd say the 49ers held serve.
Lions win by 2.
What?
23-21. Yes. Joe Montana threw for, listen to this, Joe Montana threw for only 97 yards, and that was the high. How the hell did the Lions win that game?
That bum Montana screwed up my perfect record for the week.
There you go. The Redskins go to the Meadowlands to take on the New York Football Giants.
I'll say the Giants won that one at home.
Giants win 17-3. The Saints go into Fulton County Stadium to take on Chadley's Falcons.
Ooh, heated rivalry. The Saints were trash in the 80s. I will say Atlanta.
Falcons win 31-24. The St. Louis Cardinals head to Three Rivers to take on the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Pittsburgh at home. Oh, wait, they were kind of shitty in the 80s.
Steelers win. Okay, no, Steelers win 23-10. There you go. The Colts head into Buffalo to take on the Bills.
Buffalo at home, Jim Kelly. K-Gun.
Vince Ferragamo started for the Bills, but yes. But the Bills win 21-9.
Yes.
I think Kelly, 85, I don't know if he was still in the USFL.
I was going to say, I think the Bills only won two games in 1984.
I know. The Rams, LA Rams go into Arrowhead to play the Chiefs.
Chiefs are tough at home, so I'll go with them in Arrowhead.
Rams throw a shutout, 16-0, even though the Chiefs held Eric Dickerson to only 68 yards. Weird. Here we go, and the Jet fans in the crowd can pick this one. The Jets go to Foxborough, to take on the New England Patriots.
Pass coming off their Super Bowl year. The Jets had played them tough in the playoffs before that. I'm going to take my J-E-T-S, Jets.
Pats win at Foxborough, 20-13, and this was the Patriots Super Bowl year, not the previous one.
That's right.
They're heading in, but we don't. But
the Jets did play in the playoffs that year, right? I think they did.
Yes, they did. The Battle of the Sunshine State as the Tampa Bay Buccaneers go down to the Orange Bowl to take on Dan Marino and the Dolphins.
Oh, the Bucs are trash. I will say Miami takes that one.
Dolphins win, but not a blowout. 41-38. As a matter of fact, Steve DeBerg threw for 365 yards for the Bucs in the loss. The Seahawks go out to, almost said Three Rivers, went out to Mile High to take on Mr. Elway and the Broncos.
Yeah, I'll take Elway.
Broncos win 13-10 in overtime. And on Monday night, this is actually a pretty memorable game, the Packers go to Soldier Field to take on the Bears.
Chicago.
Yes, Bears win 23-7. If you remember, and this might have been the idea for Mr. McMahon in WrestleMania 2, because this was the first time you saw William the Refrigerator Perry line up in the backfield, and he scored a touchdown in this game. So very memorable. So there's your week 7.
Pretty strong, Scott. Only 3 wrong. I think that's pretty damn good.
Very solid.
Yeah. And
very
Montana, solid. I didn't think that was going to count. I mean, come on. That's one of the odds of that.
Great weekend in college football. One faced two in Iowa City. Number one Iowa, I remember this game actually, on a last second field goal, beat number two Michigan 12-10. Elsewhere, numbers 2, 3, and 4 all lost. Third ranked Oklahoma loses to Miami 27-14. And fourth ranked Arkansas lost to Texas 15-13. Fifth-ranked Florida blew out Louisiana Lafayette 45-0. Number 6, Penn State beat Syracuse 24-20. Nebraska beat Missouri 28-20. They were ranked 7th. Auburn, number 8, beat Georgia Tech 17-14. BYU, number 9, beat New Mexico 45-23. And 10th-ranked Air Force beat Colorado State 35-19. The NHL season started a few weeks before, only one game today. The Nordiques beat the Canadiens at the Forum 3-2. We mentioned Dire Straits a moment ago. 9 days before, on October 12th, Dire Straits came to the Garden as part of their Brothers in Arms tour. And an interesting death in history, JR, and it might be obscure if you didn't see a movie. Did any of you see the movie Milk?
Yes.
I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
Okay. Milk, of course, was about Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay man to win an election. He was named to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Sean Penn played him in the movie. On this day in 1985, October 21st, the man who assassinated Harvey Milk and the San Francisco mayor, George Moscone, committed suicide, Dan White. If you saw the movie, he was played by Josh Brolin. Dan White, there was a lot of controversy between them. And Dan White, in November of 1978, walked into San Francisco City Hall, shot the mayor, and then shot Harvey Milk. He was convicted of manslaughter, not murder, which was very upset the San Francisco gay community, which led to the infamous White Knight riots. He spent time in prison, and then on this date,
still going on many message boards and Twitter today. Lots of White Knight riots out there.
And then on this date, October 21st, 1985, Dan White committed suicide. So there you go. There is your pop culture report for October 21st, 1985. All right. Back to the Garden.
Oh,
and we have a few things to discuss before our next match. In fact, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to discuss for our next match. We have a presentation in the ring, JR. Mean Gene is in the ring. What is he presenting?
He He is presenting a special presentation, Scott, right here at the home of WrestleMania, announces that the VHS of WrestleMania has gone platinum. WWF is proud of their fans that were part of the show here in New York City. Fink then leans in and talks into his hands like a creep to Gene, which I thought was weird. Followed by Vince McMahon himself heading to the ring alongside his trusted loyal soldiers, Jim Troy, Arnold Scollin, and George Scott. The British Bulldogs are following them out as well with a giant plaque. And Gene awards it to Vince for being a genius in creating WrestleMania. He says Vince's dad would have been proud of him, and they officially grant him the Outstanding Achievement Award to a okay round of applause. Vince blushes and thanks the crowd and pays tribute to his grandfather and father, and then credits the fans for the success. Weird, kind of memorable segment here. Vince giving himself a Standing Achievement Award. To his credit, I guess he's kind of humble about it. At least he doesn't give like a grandstanding speech. I guess it's not needed when you're giving yourself an outstanding award in front of, you know, 18,000 people. But any stories behind this, Kelly, that you're aware of, or any insight?
I don't know really. I mean, why it happened? I guess the video went platinum. And Vince, you know, he had a pretty good year, and he wanted to reward himself with a gigantic plaque.
The millions of dollars he's made, that wasn't enough?
Yeah, no, I guess not. Well, it's Vince McMahon we're talking about, so.
Plaque is fucking gigantic, though. It's like the biggest thing I've ever seen.
I know.
Huge. It's like a bedboard or something. It's ridiculous. This thing's huge.
Yeah, I want to think that Vince still has it hanging up somewhere in his mansion or something. One of his greatest achievements. The most interesting thing about this is it's like a rare look at the behind the scenes, you know, power structure of the WWF at this time, and sort of a rare look at Vince as the owner, as the promoter. That was never acknowledged. And here it wasn't even really explicitly said that he was the promoter of the WWF. They did say his father had been and his grandfather had been.
I think that's what they were alluding to. I almost feel like it was almost
Oh, it was totally implied, but they tiptoed around actually saying that Vince is the owner of the company.
Right.
And the people that came with him, it's interesting because these were his right hand. Jim Troy was his right hand man at the time. A guy who's kind of forgotten to WWF history because I think he left the company around 88 or so, definitely before the 80s ended. But he was with Vince right at the beginning when Titan Sports was founded. He was actually a hockey player in the 70s in the WHA, which was a rival hockey league to the NHL. And Vince actually owned a minor league hockey team, the Cape Cod Buccaneers, in the early 80s. And he owned he owned the stadium too. He owned the Cape Cod Coliseum, and that's where he promoted. In addition to wrestling, rock concerts and hockey. And he made Troy the head coach and GM of the team. And that's how they met. And then from there, they became intertwined in business. And so it's interesting to see him on camera. George Scott was the booker at this time, actually. He was famously the booker of the Carolinas in the 70s when they were red hot, and when they first brought in Ric Flair and had Ricky Steamboat and all those guys and all that great talent and great feuds. So yeah, this was a very interesting moment. And Arnold Scollin, hell, the golden
doing
boy,
nothing as always. Yes,
doing nothing as always. They should have made him carry the plaque.
Would have had a heart attack probably.
But yeah, this is such a random thing. I didn't know this existed until I think somebody on PWO posted it.
Yeah, I think so. That's where I remember seeing it. Because I know I had seen it or read about it. I'm pretty sure it was there.
Yeah. That's an interesting bit of obscure WWF history, that's for sure.
That's a fact. Make a lot of men drop on this big black bedboard. That's a fact.
And it's funny, too, that they call out who George Scott and Jim Troy are, like, on commentary. I thought maybe they just have him come out and not call attention. But I'm guessing Vince brought them, so it wasn't like he wasn't being fully self-aggrandizing. He kind of made it like it was his team that were winning this award, you know, versus him just taking all the full credit coming out. So I'm guessing he had them come out with him just to add a little bit of, okay, well, you know, it's not just me here. My boys are all winning this award.
Yeah. And Vince is all about family. You know, he always says it. It's all the company's one big family. So here's his part of his family.
Very strange. But, you know, self-aggrandizing is what Vince enjoys doing. We go backstage, and we have a couple of interviews, JR. What do we
have? Well, we have Gene going to chat with Bruno Sammartino. We'll be making a stop by Piper's Pit tonight. Bruno says he dressed down. This is so great. Like, Bruno, the attention to detail. So he's wearing a polo shirt tucked into slacks. And he says, I'm dressed down tonight so he can be ready to step into action in case Piper tries to make a fool out of him. And he even
takes going to the pool hall.
Well, he even takes the time to explain, like, I didn't want to wear my suit in case I need to get physical, but I couldn't go out there in my trunks because I'm not wrestling. So he had to go in between with this casual polo shirt. You know, it's like it was such a cool like touch of like someone that has paid so much attention to the little things. And he kind of, you know, foreshadows what's going to happen. Gene says he's ready for an explosion, and Bruno says he doesn't want to do this, and he hopes Piper will be a gentleman, but he is ready in case he isn't. And then Gene talks to Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik and Fred Blassie about their match with the British Bulldogs tonight. Blassie says this is a stepping stone to the regaining the tag team titles. Nikolai says the belts were stolen from them, and after they win tonight, they'll go after Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake. Or as he says, Beefcake Brutus. Sheik says they're ready for the Bulldogs and calls out the champs as well. I kind of like how they're setting up everyone as going after the titles. You know, it's not just like a heel face thing. So I thought that was kind of neat that they called them out. But the Beefcake Brutus.
I do love when Sheik goes, cameraman, zoom in! When he starts posing. Cameraman, zoom in, Gene Min! You're a very intelligent man! Love the Sheik. Yes, Beefcake Brutus! That's right. A few years ago, he says Beefcake Barber, so whatever. That's right. Maybe that's what set a trend. All right, so we get to the ring, JR. And it is time now for what you could, I guess you could say, is probably the main event of this show. And that is the big Piper's Pit. In comes the Hot Rod with his second in command, Mr. Cowboy Bob Orton. And in, complete with his slacks, his tucked in polo shirt, ready to go to Shecky's to play pool, Mr. Bruno Sammartino.
Before we get to all that, so the Fing comes out first, welcomes out Piper and Orton for a special live Piper's Pit. Piper says the king has arrived and hugs Ace and pokes fun at the local sports teams and comments about the mayor shutting down bathhouses in the city, asking how the fans will go to get clean.
What? He said, Piper, I don't know what the fuck he was smoking this night.
It
literally gets
everything.
Worse from here, or better, depending on your point of view.
He says they named the city New York, New York, because people here can't remember stuff the first time, and then brings in a male and female fan into the ring and asks them to have a seat. Stephanie, who comes in, is quite fetching, and Tim White from Queens, yes, that Tim White, says he would choose New York if Piper offered him a ticket to anywhere in the world. Stephanie is also from New York and says her favorite wrestler is Paul Orndorff, to a big pop. Piper says, is Orndorff better looking than me? And she says, yes. Piper offers her a chance for a date with him, and she declines it. Piper trashes Stephanie and kicks her out of the ring. Tim says his favorite wrestler is Hulk Hogan, and he gets booted immediately by Piper. Piper says it's just a waste of time talking to people from New York, and then calls out Bruno for a visit. Piper says Bruno should play for the Yankees because he can't hit anything. They can't hit anything anymore either. An official comes out and tells Piper that Bruno will only come out if Piper introduces him properly as the living legend. Piper obliges and Bruno comes out but says if he's going to be here, the garbage needs to leave, and that's Cowboy Bob. Of course, Orton doesn't go, and Bruno says if he doesn't leave, then I'll get a friend to watch my back. Piper sends Orton out and says he will be okay, but first they hug. Both men have a seat, and Piper starts off by saying Bruno is so much uglier than he is and then apologizes to him. Piper says he talks about the living legend nickname, and Bruno pulls the mic in and says he got that name because he shut up a bunch of people in his career. Piper notes that Bruno wrestled in MSG 211 times. He says Bruno's stupid for wrestling that many times while being clearly washed up. Bruno says even on the 211th time he kicked butt. Piper comments that Bruno's lost weight. Bruno says he's down to 245 pounds and in fantastic shape. Piper says Bruno's lost some hair, but Bruno said he lost hair just like his father did, and he lived to be 95. Bruno says he's proud to be from Italy, where they don't wear skirts. Piper gets fired up and says that he isn't the one that has a fat puke son toting around his daddy's name. Bruno tells him to interview him like a man or he'll leave. Piper asks if Bruno, even in his prime 15 years ago, can hang like a guy with Piper, like Piper, who's in his prime right now. Piper mocks Bruno's ears and nose and asks him clearly. And Bruno says if Piper was there 15 years ago, he would have squashed him like a grape, and he still could now. Piper calls him a stupid wop, and then Bruno decks him to a huge pop. Bruno turns his back to leave, and Piper levels him with a chair and then presses it to his neck before ripping his shirt off and nailing with the mic. Bruno fights back to his feet, grabs a chair, but Piper ducks it and takes it off, and then takes off. I thought it was an awesome segment with insane heat. Both guys were locked in and out point. And I thought it was really cool that Bruno was able to out-duel and frustrate Piper, because no one ever does. And he had an answer and was ahead of the game on everything. And I thought it made Bruno look really cool that he could go out there and match wits with Piper. This was an awesome segment. Best of the night, easily. Best pit, I think, maybe. Well, obviously the stuff at War of the Settle the Score was really good, too. Or that led up to that. But this one was really good. One of the best I've ever seen. The WAP moment is great. You stupid WAP man, and the Bruno just decks him. Just a great, great moment, a great, great scene. What do you think, Kelly, of this? And I know it didn't lead to anything in MSG. Of course, we've talked about that, how it kind of veers off to other locations. But what do you think of this moment and kind of where it leads?
Oh, I yeah, it's amazing. Two of the all-time great talkers squaring off. I mean, Bruno is criminally underrated as a promo. We've gone over this on Titans quite a bit, and he's just so good. Just in that promo he did in the dressing room before, mm-hmm. like with the little touches and the little details. I mean, that's typical Bruno. He was so old school. He was so into the old way of building things logically and doing it, you know, all that way. And he was so great. And he doesn't feel out of place at all with Piper. Piper was at his peak here, and Bruno just fits right in. He's able to come up with all the quick responses and comes off as a badass, as always. So that was all great. And, you know, Piper's reaction to the skirt line by Bruno was awesome, where he, like, hops up on the top turnbuckle. He's so shocked and can't believe Bruno actually said that. And then the attack on Bruno was cool, mm-hmm. because he attacks him with a chair, targeting his neck, which for longtime fans at MSG would harken back to the match with Stan Hansen.
Stan Hansen,
oh, Stan Hansen. Yep. Right.
Yeah, 76, where his neck was broken on a botched body slam, but they credited it to the lariat. And then Bruno was out for several months and came back. So that was a nice touch. You know, that was like Bruno's Achilles heel, basically, his neck. And yeah, it doesn't lead to a match in MSG, but they do run matches at NASA Coliseum, and then most famously at the Boston Garden. Those are on tape and are out there, and they're actually really good. The cage match they have at Boston Garden is awesome. Just an awesome match. I don't know if you guys have seen it before. It's right after the Super Bowl, so Piper comes out with posters of Jim McMahon and Refrigerator Perry and tapes them up to the cage to antagonize the fans of Boston because the Patriots lost in the Super Bowl.
It's awesome.
Bears. And then the match they have is just off the charts. Crazy. And they were two of the best brawlers of all time, too. Bruno was a great brawler. Piper was, like we've talked about, you guys have been talking about for months, all his great brawls. Anyone out there listening, check out this Piper's Pit first and foremost, and then check out the Piper Bruno matches in Boston Garden. They're fantastic, and this was an awesome segment.
Nah, I agree 100%. It was very well done. Typical Piper. You know, Bruno's still over. There's no doubt about that. Even though he's not really wrestling much, and we see 1986, and we add some other. You know, some other volatile guys to the mix, it becomes just even more nuclear, which is what we'll really be looking forward to as we move ahead. All right, our next match has a combination match slash another appearance. This one to me seems almost as out of place as when Snuka came back at WrestleMania 5. So, JR, what do we have?
The Fink heads in the ring and introduces the Japanese women's tag team champions, the Crush Girls, and they get booed by the fans. They shake hands with Fink and each other or whatever, and then exit. It's Jesse questions if they're even really women because, of course, they have like, short hair and stuff.
Fucking show is just ridiculous.
Gorilla puts over the importance of the garden and says wrestlers travel that far just to be recognized here at MSG. Odd segment. Kelly, right? The Crush Girls are getting booed out of the arena here for some reason.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, there was still the connection. Well, I mean, this was, All Japan Women, so this wasn't even New Japan or anything. Right. But I guess there was still a connection, because they do actually wrestle on an MSG show coming up in 1986. And they're a legendary team. I'm not a fan of Joshi. Not to say it's not great. I've seen bits and pieces here and there. But I don't really know much about it. I know the big names and all that. But, very odd, random appearance. Yeah, like Dr. Jerry Graham turned up a few months ago.
Yes, that was...
You never know who is going to come out from wrestling's past and internationally, I guess.
Come out and be recognized and get booed.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, you know who didn't get booed? Otto Vons. The great Otto Vons.
Otto Vons, too.
Otto Vons with that gigantic, like, size 87 white tuxedo. Look like a Bond villain. That was really funny.
Oh, and one thing I forgot to mention is Asuka. She took her name from one of the Crush girls, Lioness Asuka. So that was a tribute to her.
She'd have been in Survivor Series 95, right? Isn't that her?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, yeah, that's right. That crazy match. Yeah.
Mm. Interesting. And so after that happens, JR, it leads us to our next match, which is...
More booing, as Paul Orndorff is out. Red hot still, but here against the spoiler, our old friend. Of course, he is actually substituting for the missing Link, who's
finally gone.
Yes.
Finally missing.
From his reviews.
Forever.
We talked about it last last show, but it was, sad to see him go. I enjoyed his brief run here. So spoilers back against the red hot Paul Orndorff, coming off his great Saturday Night's Main Event brawl with Piper. The 50K bounty is still out there for the taking. Jesse says here Gorilla could be the one to do it. Again, reminds him of all the fun he could have in Atlantic City with that money. I wonder if he remembers that they've talked about this stuff, or if they just act like it's new every time. Like, he didn't think he actually mentioned that last month. But spoiler grabs a headlock to start and then lands a series of blows to the neck before choking away with his foot. Jesse says Orndorff is too worried about getting his pretty face messed up, and Gorilla denies that. Spoiler keeps stomping away, landing a blow off the middle rope. Orndorff comes back and works the arm, but Spoiler breaks the hold and chokes away to regain control. Spoiler meanders through his offense and grabs a claw hold, which he keeps locked in for a while. Orndorff finally fights free and hip tosses Spoiler over the top, but Spoiler hangs on to the hold. Orndorff breaks free again and punches and elbows away before trying to rip the mask off, which Jesse chastises. Orndorff gets it untied, but Spoiler buries a knee before he can yank it off. Orndorff dodges another claw attempt and punches away and then rakes the eyes across the ropes. Orndorff hits an atomic drop and lands an elbow off the middle rope before trying to go to the mask again. Spoiler pushes Orndorff off of him, but after a crisscross, Orndorff drills him with a clothesline for the win. Really shit match yet again. The never-ending claw hold and the weird mask stuff. Even Gorilla tried to explain it as Orndorff wanting to reveal who was Heenan sent after him. So, like, they tried, but it just was odd. And it was to the point where he kept doing it so much that I really thought it was going to be someone else under the mask. And they were going to, like, have it be a reveal of someone that Heenan sent after the bounty. Because the way he kept going after him, I thought it was paying off something. A slight bump here because Orndorff's glimmers of offense were okay, but... this really wasn't good in any way. It went half a star just because the brief moments of Orndorff on offense. What'd you think, Scott?
I agree. And Orndorff is still hot, but once again, I mean, where was everybody?
Right.
I mean, couldn't Orndorff have faced? I mean, what other heels could have been? Were the Dream Team in the building? Could you have like Valentine come out, like Bobby and Johnny Valiant are like chatting it up about the money? I mean, I don't know. They made no effort, no legit effort to really fill these sub spots. It's one thing for earlier with Wyndham, obviously, and then the mass superstar. But this is a big storyline going on right now, and you fill the slot with a fucking scrub.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get it. Kelly, I mean, what do you think? This is a pretty big storyline. It's probably one of the top three in the company right now. And this is the best you do? There's no one else in the building?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Scott. And the fans turn on this match immediately. You can hear
that. I think so.
They're chanting, "We want Link."
Right.
And they're pissed that they didn't get the because this would have been the advertised match, missing Link and Orndorff.
And that was well built and hyped too.
Months and months, and you get a last second sub of a guy that really he was in the WWF earlier in the year, but I don't think he'd been around at all. His name didn't mean anything in the territory. So this was a big letdown for what had been a big angle. Yeah, so I totally agree. The fans had a right to shit all over this.
It's dreadful. It's just utterly dreadful. And I think that hurts Orndorff a bit. And I understand the mask thing, but you also don't want to lose the match. So that didn't balance out enough for it to be, legit and make any kind of sense.
Plus, we've seen the spoiler. Like, why not just throw someone under a mask and say they're going after the bounty? And then it makes sense to rip off the mask. Like, he knows the spoiler's probably just the spoiler. Like, he's not someone that Heenan, you know, contracted to go under a mask to take him out. The whole thing was just weird. You could tell it was probably thrown together pretty haphazardly. But, like, why not just throw anyone under a hood and have Orndorff try to be obsessed with the mask, saying, you know, who is it that Bobby put under this mask to come get me? At least that's more of a story than this. And the spoiler was trash anyway. So it's like, what's, you know, it's not like you're saving it by putting a good wrestler in there. The whole thing was just
right.
Awful.
It was really awful. No, it was really awful.
Senseless.
Senseless. What's not senseless is our last match.
Before that, though, which, Scott, the Fink actually comes to the ring to run down the next month's card. And he tells us that
this.
Jesse Ventura will accept Barry O's challenge. So.
All right.
We'll have a tag team title match. We'll have Ricky Steamboat and Don Morocco reprising their feud in a women's title match as well. So.
Really? Very interesting. Oh.
Eyebrows are raised.
There we go. Eyebrow raised.
The Foreign Legion.
The Foreign Legion. And once again, no Hogan in November. Well, maybe there will be. Who knows? Although Kelly, I think, already said that he's not going back till December. So there goes all the drama of that. Our main event, yes, our main event, in essence, is a, you mentioned it, JR, in essence, like a number one contenders match
yes.
here between two top teams, and they were mentioned earlier, they are the Foreign Legion. Foreign Legion.
just another malady for me, the Foreign Legion, it's all over my body. Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov taking on the British Bulldogs. Took you a minute. Usual heat on the Foreign Legion as Nikolai sings the national anthem, and the Bulldogs storm the ring and attack them to drive them out. Jesse said he didn't know the Brits disliked the Soviets so much, and then puts over Nikolai's beautiful tenor voice. The match starts off with Volkov and Davey, with Nikolai controlling and quickly tagging in Sheik, who goes right to work with a backdrop and clothesline for two. Nikolai comes in and clubs away, but misses a charge in the corner, allowing Davey to grab the arm and tag in Dynamite, who comes off the top with a double axe. Dynamite works the arm as well, but he escapes and tags in Sheik, who hits a gut-wrench suplex for two. Dynamite blocks a suplex and hits one of his own, but he's too banged up to take advantage. Dynamite comes back with a sunset flip for two, but Sheik drags him to the corner and makes a tag, allowing the heavy offense to continue. Jesse says the winners of this match certainly will get a tag title match soon, and credits Nikolai for military pressing Hogan back on Saturday's main event. Nikolai hotshots Dynamite across the top rope and then stuffs him with a pile driver for two. Sheik and Volkov collide, allowing Dynamite to make the tag to Davey, who comes in and drops Sheik with a power slam, but Nikolai breaks up the pin. Sheik found some daylight by kicking Davey to block a backdrop and then hits a German suplex into a camel clutch. Dynamite comes in and breaks the hole, but he gets knocked to the floor. The Legion starts to double-team Davey. Volkov hoists Davey up, but Dynamite comes off the top rope and drop-kicks Davey into Sheik for the win. I thought this was a fun sprint. It could use some time to develop. The pacing was great, though. It never let up. A nice win for the Bulldogs on a roll. Like you said, Scott, pretty much a de facto number one contenders match for the tag titles. And I went 2.5 on this, and I wanted more. I was sad it ended in 6:46. Maybe a tick high for a short match, but they never stopped. They never slowed down. I really dug it. It was a good match. What'd you think, Kelly?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, they were fighting the clock because this would have been in the curfew spot, so that's why it was so short. They maybe could have put this one on earlier in the card and give more time, but it accomplished its mission. It made the Bulldogs look great. They beat the former champs decisively and are now basically locked in for the Dream Team. And Bulldogs look great. Great offense. Always pops the crowd. And, yeah, but, I mean, yeah, too short to really be anything to recommend. But, two stars is what I gave it. That sounds about right.
They could have taken 11 minutes off of Pedro and Ray Goulet. And then
there's
maybe
a lot of matches they could have axed out of this.
Oh, yeah.
The show.
This one could have been a 60-minute match if you
That would have been great.
You could have cut down that Rotundo match by 10 minutes. It made that 6 and made this 16. I mean, I think that's what I would have probably done. But this was probably maybe slated for longer. Like you said, Kelly, maybe a curfew issues, cut it short. But
yeah.
No, I enjoyed this match a lot. Another team that I'm watching a lot of, I feel is unheralded. Sheik and Volkov worked good in the ring together. Combination of, you know, technical prowess and just pure power. Same thing with the Bulldogs. Same thing. You know, you got technical prowess and pure power. Fantastic match. And this kind of tells you that, you know, obviously the Bulldogs were slated for bigger and better things. I give this 2.5 as well. It was a great finisher for what was kind of a maudlin show. And You like that? Pull that word. Maudlin and malady. I think that's Crush Girl's other names. You know, it was a good ending to the show. The fans went home happy. Bulldogs are red hot, and ends an otherwise bit of a stinker. So there you go. That wraps up our the show, October 21st, 1985. But JR, you know what that means?
Awards.
The awards.
All right, here we go. Match of the night, gentlemen. I went with the double colossal jostle this evening. What'd you do, Scott?
I don't know. I think I got to go with the main event. I think I got to go with Bulldogs against Sheik and Volkov. I think I got to go with that.
How about you, Kelly?
I went with the double colossal jostle as well.
Can we convince you, Scott? You're going to make us write down two names here. I mean, the double colossal jostle had had all the heat. It had the build. It had the haircut and the slam. I mean, there was a lot there. You're taking on a 6-minute tag match. It really just had nothing going for it. Over that?
I hate Hillbilly Jim, and he fucking sucks.
Come on. He's the best of the hillbillies.
Prejudice. Ugh.
What does that tell you?
It tells me he was the best
really?
Of the hillbillies.
Really? I read that Puerto Rico card, and you're killing me. Meanwhile, you say Hillbilly Jim's the best of the hillbillies? It's like it's like saying, King To or what is it? Little Tokyo is the best midget. I mean, come on. All right, I'll roll with it for Kelly. But
it was easily the match of the night. I mean, if Bulldog Sheik, I mean, I had them both at 2.5 stars. But if Sheik
Kelly,
and Volkov, if they had more time, I would have said okay. But
all right, well, Kelly, I want a signed by all five former great members of Titans Wrestling, a full blown 79-83 Chief J Strongbow comp, and I expect full alternate commentary. Uh-huh. Okay, with Sorrow's nephew. And no. All right, that's fine. I'll roll with it. Only because Stud Bunny and Andre are great, and they carry that fucking sorry pile of shit. Speaking of the Drizzler, I'm giving it to Hillbilly.
No, the Drizzler worst match of the night. I think Gator Wolf versus Gibbs was this was a night full of shit matches, but that was easily the shittiest. Do you guys both agree?
The shittiest of the there was a lot of Drizzlers. I dribbled longest.
I'm going with Tonga and Shaw. That was the only one I actually gave a dud to. I did give half a star to the Gator Wolf Gibbs, just for Gibbs, basically. Mm-hmm. Tonga and Shaw was just so boring and bad.
Yeah. All right.
I mean, it's a coin toss. I mean, they're both.
Horrible. We'll put them both
There's no right answer.
All right. Our MVP of the night, I went with Roddy Piper and Bruno Sammartino in a tie.
No doubt about it. No doubt.
I just went with Bruno. But Piper was great, too. But, I mean, I love Bruno so much.
Yeah, I feel like Piper was really so good at setting him up. You know, he really, for once, Yeah, I mean, he set himself that line alone. But he set himself up to be kind of a stooge for this time. When he usually is always the one coming out on top, he kind of showed his respect for Bruno and let him get over on him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, our spoiler award for the worst wrestler of the night. I gave this to Steve Gatorwolf. I thought he was easily the worst guy on this show. Come on.
Steve Gatorwolf's a hillbilly. He's just an Indian hillbilly.
He was fucking terrible. I mean, wanted to give it the spoiler. I mean, spoiler's the fucking worst. But I thought Gatorwolf outworked him as the worst on this week.
I will say for the spoiler, I mean, he was a legend at one time in the 70s. It seems kind of wrong to forever have the worst worker award named after him.
You want to change it to the Gatorwolf?
Let's change it to the Gatorwolf. Okay. Yeah, because I'm going with Gator.
We should call it the Jose Luis Rivera Award, since he's the only one that's gotten it more than once. So.
True.
And he's going to have future opportunities at more. Well,
let's go get Gatorwolf. Let's go with the Gatorwolf, because it's funnier. And if Rivera gets a couple more, maybe we can talk about switching it. But I like the Gatorwolf. That's a good name.
Cool.
All right. Best moment, I went with Andre slamming Stud, because the place just went like fucking bananas, and they cut his hair. Like, it was just such a great moment of revenge. And you could tell he's so determined to do it, because he tries once, fails, and then boom, does it again. That's my choice, Scott. How about you?
Yeah, I agree with that. Crowd went crazy.
Kelly?
Yeah, I'm going with the brawl on Piper's Pit as the best moment.
Okay. I mean, that was really good, too. Obviously, you could tell where the highlights of the show were. Those two.
Yeah.
Two
yeah, that was about it.
All right, so Andre slam Stud, and then Kelly. If I could type, it'd be easier. Piper. Bruno.
Well, he's typing that. Let's talk about the Junior Mr. Universe Award.
I'm stumbling all over the place.
Let's see. Well, Atlas was on here, so he could get it for the unprecedented fourth time.
I went with someone different, though. Who do you have?
Yeah, so did I.
If you say Steve Gatorwolf, I'm quitting. All right.
He ate the most, but it wasn't steroids.
He was pretty big. Yeah.
I went with Dynamite Kid.
Yeah, he was pretty chiseled.
I thought he was, like, every time I see him with all that fucking weight. I mean, we gave it to the Bulldogs before. I mean, I could give it to both of them again. I thought Dynamite was, like, extra fucking shredded on the show. Who are you going with, Kelly?
I'm going with both Bulldogs. Okay. But, yeah, I mean, Dynamite probably was a hair more juiced than Davey Boy.
We can go with both. You on board with that, Scott?
Yeah, that's fine. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, and then the overall grade for the show out of 10, I went with... I mean, I can't believe it ended up being this high, but I went 4 out of 10. And that's only because of the Piper's Pit and the Colossal Jostle were so good in the main event. And even for the memorability of, like, the Vince segment 2 was kind of classic. You know, something kind of a hidden gem. So what started and looked to be, like, an all-time worst show was kind of bailed out by some of that stuff toward the end. What'd you think, Scott? And that's actually the lowest grade I've given, though, for anything. So
I'm going to give it a 1, and that's all for Piper. No, I'm only kidding. I'm going to give it a – I'm not giving it a 4. I'm going to give it a 3.5.
Okay.
And Piper and Bruno get about 3.
God, you're such a hillbilly hater.
Three and a quarter. I'm sorry. Am I stealing your hillbilly hating thunder? I'll just.
I never listen. I always said Hillbilly Jim was above my. I didn't mind him. It was the other fucking fools that I couldn't stand, and Elmer and Junior and Luke and other idiots. Those are the guys
exposed.
I can't stand. Hillbilly Jim, I thought was fine. Like I never had an issue with him. He was like as far as we can go. Like he was just enough. We didn't need the whole fucking brigade stomping on hats and fucking around.
The brigade.
Like that's where my issues come in.
Take Hillbilly out of it. The undercard is just unbelievably bad.
But I've always said I'm going to weight the good more than the bad on these shows because I anticipate these shows all being trash. You know what I mean? Like, I just assume there'll be a lot of bad matches on these things. So.
Yeah. Yep.
I start there, and if I'm impressed by things, I go up. So, like, I never come in thinking, like, this could be, like, an 8 or something, like, I detract. I go the other way. I say my baseline is a bunch of sludge, and I was entertained in, like, 4 matches or 3 segments or whatever. So that, to me, that bumps it.
This was a pile of sludge, and Piper saved it from being less than a 3.5 for me. So I'm going 3.5.
I was thinking 3.5, but I went with 4 based, you know, with that all-time great Piper's Pit, I think you have to have 4 sounds about right. Because that's a segment, that's one for the highlight reel, if nothing else. That should be on comps and everybody should see. So I think having something like that on a show, it's something. But oh god, yes, the undercard was bad even by like 1975. MSG standards that we went through a few years back on Titan.
Trust me, I would have begged for a Dean Ho match at this point. I think that would have definitely upgraded the undercard.
Oh, God. Yeah, there was a sign in the crowd, though, earlier. You guys probably saw it, or they pointed it out, Jesse and Gorilla, that said WWF plus MSG equals fun. they picked the wrong show.
Right, not this one.
Unveil that sign, and they'll probably burn it afterwards and never see it.
I'm sorry, what was the grade you gave, Kelly?
Oh, 4. I give it a 4.
Okay. All right. So there you go. Another one in the books, guys. As shitty as it was, still a lot of fun to talk about, like we expected it to be. Kelly, I think your seamless transition is we're going nicely as we break you in here to the show. So I want to appreciate, give you a moment to appreciate you coming in here again. Scott, our next two shows will be coming at our fans at some point. Before WrestleMania. There's some scheduling quirks going on between now and the week of Mania, but we're going to try and squeeze 2 out. That is our 5th review of all time of the Halloween Saturday's Main Event from 11/2/85.
I think we should just chop it up into one big montage.
My lord. I just watched it again, too, so I'm well-versed. So that one's done. And then also we'll have the Wrestling Classic. So those are our next 2. So we get a little break from the house shows. So we'll get those in sometime before WrestleMania, and then we'll be back with the November 85 house show. We have a special guest for that one, not Kelly, but Kelly will be back soon as well. I do want to take a moment just to plug this week's Clotheslines and Headlines. I will not be on. I will be at that Celtics game I mentioned earlier. But Glenn and Steve and Nate will be hosting. Mr. D'Amato will be on to talk about his experience at Ring of Honor. And speaking of Ring of Honor, guys, the new world champion, Christopher Daniels, will be joining Steve Willey for a very special interview on Clotheslines and Headlines to talk about his title win. So I want to thank Mr. Ben Morris at Marvel, of course, for setting that up for us. He's an okay guy. So we'll be talking to Christopher Daniels. D'Amato will be on. Glenn was at Shikara in New England over the last couple weeks, so he'll talk about his live experience there. Steve was at Fastlane. He'll talk about his attendance for that show as well. So big Clotheslines and Headlines coming this week. Be sure to check that out. Of course, our WrestleMania Listomania series continues, Scott. We're on today, I believe, 14 of 33 have been posted already, where we're doing different lists of WrestleMania history, 33 of them. Today was the greatest tag team title matches. So be sure to check those out each and every day, PlayStation.com at 10 a.m. Those go up. Must reads. And, of course, we'll implore you to visit PlayStation.com/Amazon to do all of your shopping as the days and weeks roll on, and Facebook.com/PlayStation, place number 2B Nation on Twitter. Any questions or comments you may have. Scott, anything you want to plug or talk about?
No, everything's good. Last week's main event was excellent. I will actually be hosting later this week. Actually, it'll be on Wednesday, right before the technically first round begins. It'll be on the PTBM pop feed. We will be doing the March Madness preview. We kind of transitioned it off this our feed here, JR, but we will be on the pop feed on Wednesday. Myself, Mr. Reish, Mr. Crosland, and my special ombudsman, which I'll talk about in the next show. We'll go over the entire NCAA tournament. We will see who will play SMU, JR. Mm-hmm. They'll be going on probably as we're recording. Of course, a couple games tomorrow night as well. But we'll go through the whole bracket, get you ready for the NCAA tournament, which begins in earnest on Thursday. So there you go.
All right. Kelly, anything you want to talk about on your end?
Yeah. Well, speaking of the pop feed, Johnny Sorrow and myself have a classic comic book podcast called Imaginary Stories on there that comes out every few months. And we are working on, as we speak, an epic show on the history of Archie comics. It's been months in the making. I've been doing a lot of research because I read them as a kid, of course, but then basically forgot about them for 20 plus years. But Johnny got back into it with the Riverdale TV show that just debuted on the CW network and is actually a really, really good show. I highly recommend it. So we're working on that. It should be something I would say in the next few weeks. Look out for it. I'm really excited about that. And today, a legend of wrestling passed away, someone that you guys are quite familiar with.
Yes.
The great Dennis Stamp, 68 years old, passed away today.
He's been sick for a little while, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, I believe he's had a battle with cancer that goes back 6 or so years at least. But someone, of course, famous for his part in Beyond the Mat and not being booked. But he was trained by Vern Gagne and was a decent wrestler in the 70s, as far as I can tell. I don't think there's a lot of footage out there of him. But, Dennis Stamp is... tricks.
Legendary.
There we go. From your early years. Yeah, right. The early years of you guys' podcast. A lot of Dennis Stamp.
I stay fit. I watch what I eat because I never know when my next match is going to be. You know?
And I actually do. We talked to him on the Kevin Kelly show a couple years ago.
Oh, really? Oh, awesome.
It was a great interview. So we'll have to re-socialize that. I was going to tonight, but I didn't want people to think I was like trying to like benefit from his passing. But I really just want to share the interview because it was really off the wall.
Oh, of course.
He reads his poems that he wrote. He read some of those. And then we actually have, and I think I have it somewhere still, when we ended the interview, we were off air, but I kept rolling, and he was on for like another half hour with Kevin, like reading more poems. Like Kevin was even asking, he would just be like, oh, well, that reminds me of this poem. And he'd read another poem and just like off the fucking wall, but a really good interview and a really fun get after all the years we had talked about him. So we'll socialize that around this week. Maybe we can rerun it on the feed or something. But it was a really cool interview, and obviously, he started as, I don't want to say as a joke for many off of Beyond the Mat, but it almost reawakened like who he was in a way, you know, like kind of the,
yep.
He seemed like a goof on that, but the more you kind of learned about him and his role in wrestling and what he was about, and then the more open he became, I think he was guarded at first. Like, I remember reaching out to him way back, and he was like bitching about people mocking him and making fun of him and stuff. And then he seemed to kind of embrace it all. And really started to make the circuit and make the rounds. And I think it was a nice kind of bounce for him. And he had his book and all that stuff. So it yeah. was it was cool to see him have some nice relevance in the last years as he was sick. So, yes, for rest sure. in peace, Dennis Stamp. But yeah. a legend here at Place to Be Nation.
I'll miss you, Dennis.
Okay. There you go. All right. Well, JR, I think we're good.
Yeah, we are, sir. So, Kelly, thanks for joining us. Talk to you in a few weeks. Of course, like we said, Scott will be back at some point over the next few weeks with that Saturday Night's Main Event and with
Wrestling Classic.
So, until then, take care. We'll talk to you at some point.
Very soon.